Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 324. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, the voice of Darth Vader himself, Mr. James Jones.
Oh, yeah. No.
You said you'd sound a little deeper this week because of your condition.
Well, I don't know. I've been hearing myself sound this way for the last 3 days at this point. This is just what I know.
You're just used to it. Anyway, Mr. John Lindemann is also here.
James actually has the voice of Carrie Fisher now.
And we also have, of course, our beloved editor, Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
I've been told I sound like Kermit.
Yeah, I could see that.
Sounding like Jim Henson is a blessing, sir.
I prefer Yoda.
That's a blessing. So we have a fun show for you today. You know, after several weeks of kind of special episodes, this and that, after school specials, live retroactives, we are back to kind of doing we're back to doing the vanilla flavored RFN, which I'm actually excited to get back into because it means we're going to get to do some listener mail in the second half of the show and catch up on a lot of things that people have been asking us about lately. Some really interesting letters and questions to come up in there. And first, we have new business. I did want to mention really quick, thank you to everybody who called into the live show and or it just listened and you know, hung out in the chat room. I really appreciate everybody who made some time in their Sunday afternoon to come and participate in that. And I know we had a fantastic time. I haven't had a chance to listen to the recording yet, but I felt like it went really, really well. And you know, a big shout out, of course, goes to these guys who played the game and came to discuss it. To Greg Leahy, of course, our very good friend who made time to go do that. And it was really a treasure to hear him again. And of course, to everybody who called in and talked and asked questions and played along with it. I think that's what makes Retroactive great. And it was really fun to get to do it in a live setting. So thanks, everybody. And I hope you enjoyed the discussion.
Everybody who rang that bell.
We also, of course, on the same day that we did Retroactive and put out episode 323, there was also an episode of the Famicast, a big, like, 3.5 hour show. And just because it went out on the same day, I know the way iTunes does things sometimes, it's very easy to miss an episode if two episodes come out very close to each other. So I just wanted to remind everyone to go check that out and make sure that you did download it and make sure that you do get a chance to listen to it.
People who subscribe to the MP3 feed got it later because it was a mishap.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fine. Okay. Probably made it more likely that they saw it since it didn't come out on the same day.
Yeah.
But less likely that they saw ours.
but everyone got it, and it's out there. And if you don't if you just get the Famicast and you just kind of glaze over it and don't actually listen to it, turn around and try that again because it's a great show. It's a great show. And we really appreciate those guys doing what they do every month. So also just wanted to mention that along with Connectivity, which is on a different podcast feed, of course, very easy to find. With those three different shows all coming out in the same weekend, we released almost 8.5 hours of Nintendo podcasts that weekend. So, it's okay if you haven't heard it all yet, but don't forget to go back and catch up on all of it. So with that out of the way, let's get into the new business. And Guillaume has the absolute brand newest game to talk about this week.
Indeed. I have been playing Ika-chan. Actually, I've played it last week.
Brand new my ass.
It came out today. Yeah, well, brand new, it depends on your definition. The game has been available to play in some form since 2000, I believe.
2000?
Yeah.
I didn't know it was that old.
I think that Ika-chan was the game that, well, one of the first games that Pixel, the creator of Cave Story, made. And yeah. Cave Story came out in 2004 and took 5 years to make. So it sounds about right to me. So yeah, Ika-chan is coming out on the eShop. Once again, Nicolas is publishing it, and I think they did a pretty good job. I had never played it before, so I was a little bit taken aback by certain aspects of it, but what becomes immediately clear when you fire it up is that pixel art looks fantastic on the 3DS screen. It's so well-suited for it. I'm kind of wondering if the fact that the resolution of the 3DS screen, which is, you know, not as high as an iPhone's or a Vita's. You know, sometimes when games actually try to draw smooth lines, it's kind of distracting because there are jagged edges. But when you have pixel art, it's supposed to be jagged. So, you know, it kind of, that concern kind of fades away. And what you're left with is just sprites popping out of the screen or the parallax scrolling, the backgrounds, you know, recessing far away. And it just looks spectacular.
And you're playing it on an XL, right?
I am. Yeah, it looks great.
So the pixels are even bigger.
Yeah.
So if the game is striving to look pixelated, or if that's just the style and it's really embracing it, then having bigger pixels on the XL could actually be an improvement.
Yeah, and I do like chunky pixels. Perhaps there, you know, the game is not that pixelated. Like it looks smoother than, say, Mutant Muds, which definitely went for the pixelated look. But yeah, it's just fantastic art. If you've anyone who's played Cave Story probably knows just how cute those graphics can be. And Ika-chan looks very close to that, and the characters are just as whimsical, and just I have nothing bad to say about the art. The music is also really, really good, although it loops really, really quickly. And I was a little bit taken aback when I was playing the game and I thought I was making good progress, and about 2 hours later I finished it.
Well, you're making good progress then.
I guess, but I was like, I felt like the game was hitting its stride, and then it ended. It stopped. I've read some other reviews, and they basically said the same thing as I did in my review. That's not yet published, but will be by the time this comes out, this podcast comes out. In a way, Ika-chan was practice for the developer before Cave Story, and it kind of feels like it. The ideas are there. Like the type of level design that Cave Story has, like an open world that you explore, and kind of evolving abilities that allow you to open up new paths. But it just tries them out and then stops. For instance, you only get really two mobility upgrades. Like you get one upgrade that allows you to hit enemies with your head, basically. And the same ability will allow you to break blocks. And then at some point you get another ability that allows you to charge. And those are the only two abilities that allow you to move around better than you would normally. Like there are block paths that you open up mostly by basically talking to every NPC that you see, until you end up stumbling upon the random correct one that says something different than he used to. And there's an earthquake that happens, and then, you know, some path that was previously blocked is suddenly open.
So the game's short, but it's also $5.
Yeah.
It's a downloadable game. Mina may not have the expectation that it's going to be really... It sounds like it is much shorter than Cave Story, mm-hmm. but do you feel like it's a good enough value for, you know, for what you're probably going to pay for it?
The question of value is so tricky when you consider the fact that this has been freeware for the past 12 years.
You could say the same thing about Cave Story, though.
Sure, but Cave Story did add... more. Like they added new modes that weren't in the original release. They added improved graphics, you know, rearranged soundtrack. There definitely was more done to it. While Ika-chan is basically the game as it was, they've added, you know, 3D separation between the background and the foreground. But that's the only kind of work that was done on it, other than the act of porting it. When you beat the game, you don't unlock bus rush mode. There's only one bus anyway in the game. You don't unlock some, you know, any kind of extra that would warrant going through the game again. Cave Story had a lot of secrets. You had a lot of requirements to fulfill in order to unlock some different secret endings and things like that. Ika-chan is very straightforward, and once you've gone once through the game, you've pretty much seen it all.
So do you feel like it should have been maybe $2, like Gunman Clive, something like that?
I don't know. Like, it really... If you have an aversion for playing computer games, then, you know, like, perhaps the $5 is worth it. If you really want to see what came before Cave Story, and yet, like, you were really not that motivated to fire up your PC and play it on that, I guess it's worth it. Also, I would say that playing it on the 3DS is the absolute best way that you can experience a game, because the game looks so good on that screen. But I can't definitely say buy it. I mean, it really depends if you've played Cave Story. If you haven't, go play it now. And if you've played it enough times that, and if you're just like obsessed with it, definitely check out Ikachan if you haven't already. But it will leave you kind of unsatisfied. It will leave you unsatisfied.
But on the same day this is coming out on 3DS eShop, we're also getting the virtual console release of Ice Climbers on 3DS, which is also $5. I'm going to bet that Ikachan is a much better value than Ice Climber.
Definitely, Ikachan is a more interesting game at this point. Like, both games are pretty old.
But you're climbing ice from polar bears in pants. That's pretty interesting.
There might be polar bears in pants in Ikachan.
Are there?
No. Okay,
there you go.
I don't know. Like, Ikachan itself, like, is a squid. I didn't explain this, but he's a squid. You're underwater. And he looks very much like a blue part out of Mario. And the control, I guess, is pretty interesting also. Like, the controls that you start out with, that's what you're going to be doing through the entire game. And it's that you basically propel yourself by tapping A. You're always facing up. Like, you're always going up. Unless you tilt, you press left or right, then you kind of go at an angle. The only way that you can go down is, you know, by letting yourself fall down through gravity.
Okay. It's kind of like swimming in Mario, then.
I'd say that the swimming in the game is more interesting than Mario, because you can actually kind of build up momentum. And in the game's large cave-like areas, that can be pretty fun. Like, you can just, like, go in a wide arc, and it feels pretty satisfying. But then those large caves are separated by really, really narrow corridors, and then you're always bumping into walls or into the ceiling, and you don't go nearly as fast, and then it gets a little bit frustrating.
Yeah.
And that's all I have to say about Ikachan, I guess.
I'm probably going to pick this up. I mean, I love Cave Story so much. I like this kind of game. I'm very interested in the way that you move and the controls, so I'm probably going to pick it up. I mean, I might agree with you in the end that, wow, you know, this was a little shorter than I wanted to, but I'm okay with that. Like, I was so happy with Gunman Clive, like a game that I can start and beat in the same day or maybe the next day. Mm-hmm. And I didn't pay much money for it, but I had a really great kind of concise, tidy experience that I can very easily recommend to people. So I'm hoping this will be the same thing. Even though it costs 2.5 times as much, it's still not very expensive.
Yeah, but, you know, I have no problem recommending Liberation Maiden at, you know, almost twice the price, or I have no problem with short games. In fact, I prefer them. But Ikachan just, I expected more. Yeah.
All right, Guillaume, tell us about the other big game you've been playing this past week.
Yeah, well, for the past, has it only been a week? I kind of went through the game 3 times already.
Yeah, it's been a week, unless you got it early.
Nope, not this time. I've been playing The Cave, and I have also reviewed this, and it's Ron Gilbert's new adventure game where he tries to combine platforming and old classic point-and-click type puzzles.
Well, why don't you explain who Ron Gilbert is?
He's a really likable fellow, and the mind behind Maniac Mansion, which, you know, Nintendo fans might actually know. He worked at LucasArts.
Right.
The Secret of Monkey Island. Those are the two big games that I know he's worked on.
Right. He was in that LucasArts group that worked on all their adventure games, many of which have landed over at Double Fine.
Yeah, the golden era of LucasArts.
He basically used to be, like, above Tim Schafer at LucasArts. And now Tim Schafer is his boss at Double Fine. So that's got to be awkward. So The Cave. What am I supposed to say again?
You're supposed to tell us about The Cave.
Right. In The Cave, you've got 7 characters, very disparate characters. You've got a set of creepy twins. You've got a time traveler, a hillbilly, an adventurer, a monk, a knight, and a scientist. And you choose 3 of them, much like in Maniac Mansion, and the group of them venture into the cave, which happens to be also your narrator. And you don't really get to hear much from your characters that you pick. Mostly you hear the narrator telling their stories and just being generally pretty funny and setting the tone and just giving you a lot of foreshadowing that this is going to be, you know, very sordid stories and these characters have been very, very bad. And as the cave says, they do get what they've always wished the most for, but it changed them. So there's a lot of dark humor in the cave. So you take your team of three characters and you start out in a generic area. You've got these characters' specific areas where that's where you basically get the story or the background behind each character. And you can only access these areas using the character's special ability. And one of the things that surprised me the most was just how distinct these levels could be from one another. Like, until you get to your first character's specific level, the puzzles are very generic. Like, it's mostly like pull this lever and use this other character to go through the door and to step on this plate. And it's not really all that interesting. But once you step inside one of the character's specific levels, it's almost as if the puzzles also represented a facet of the personality of your character. For instance, my first playthrough, I played as the adventurer and the time traveler and the monk. The first area that I got to was the adventurer's. From this point on, the cave becomes kind of this tomb, this Egyptian tomb. You control your adventurer, and she's basically platforming through all sorts of traps while the other two characters are stuck in this room where the spikes are coming down on them at everything they do, every time that the adventurer progresses. And they have to step on the right plates to open up the way for her. So, you know, like, it's got this very, very mechanical type of puzzle. So I thought, all right, this is pretty cool, but I hope it's not just pressure plates and pushing blocks the whole time in this game. And then I got to the time traveler's level, and suddenly I had to deal with sending characters to the past, the present, and the future, and have them work together to play with causality. For instance, you might need the setting is kind of this museum in the future. They've got on display this old engine, and it's out of oil. So you send a character in the past to kill a dinosaur, and from there, like, you can go in the future, and you realize that there's a puddle of oil on the floor. So that's very cute, and it's very reminiscent.
Dino juice.
Yeah, it's very reminiscent of Dave the Tentacle, which Ron Gilbert didn't work on, but surely he's played it. So, you know, an entirely different type of puzzle from the first area. And then once I got to the monks, like, I was kind of dealing with, it was more like brain teasers, figuring out enigmas, like, and riddles. And if you've seen Die Hard with a Vengeance, the puzzle that they have with the jugs of water. So yeah, like, very, very varied. And I was really surprised by how the characters don't really... aren't the ones that show personality. Instead, like, it's their levels that tell you everything about them. It looks like you're kind of reenacting what they've done before, like, to get to the cave, and it kind of feels like the cave is this some sort of, like, second chance that they're getting at putting things right. The game is way more varied and a lot better looking than you might expect from just playing the demo that came out.
So, originally, when you were describing it, how there's essentially members of a party and you have to select them and they have areas they can work in, I was thinking Legacy of the Wizard kind of nonsense. which is similar, but it seems like you do much different actions in the areas, which is not... This is really more like... In that game, it's more like, well, this person can jump really high so they can get to that platform. But is it really just different gameplay styles once you get into the character-specific zones?
The special abilities that each character has don't define the characters as much as the types of puzzles that you find in their specific area. You might have, you know, some sort of special ability, but it seems to only really act as a key to get access to the character's specific area.
Yes.
It feels to me like they're kind of an afterthought, and they're mostly just an excuse to wall off, like, certain areas of the game when you don't have them in your party.
That part is a little bit Legacy of the Wizard-ish, actually. But It's once you get inside the areas, it's different. But yeah, their powers really just exist to wall off parts of the game.
So right. The difference is, I mean, I can't believe we're comparing this to Legacy of the Wizard, which is so obscure, but it's a cool game. It's a very interesting game. But in that game, it is this kind of singular, interconnected Metroid style world. Mm-hmm. But you have all four of the characters throughout the game, and you just have to learn to switch among them tactfully in order to play the game. And it's really a strict platformer. In the cave, it's that you can only, there's seven characters, you can only choose three of them every time you go through the game. And so there are entire sections of the game that you will not see.
I gotcha.
Because you don't have the right character. So, the game encourages you to play through it the entire game multiple times.
Yeah.
But Guillaume is right in that all the seven different characters, they mainly vary in terms of the story parts that go along with them and the kinds of, maybe the tone of the puzzles that you're gonna, play through in their specific sections. But in terms of the different ability, the most important ability they have is to be able to run around and pick things up and take them to other places. Yeah. That's how you solve puzzles in this game for the most part. The special powers, I mean, the time traveler has the power to like warp 6 feet in front of her, but it's almost useless. It looks cool, but you almost never have to use that.
Right.
So I was just curious how they handle the different characters interplay then.
Well, the other part is all three of the characters exist separately. Perfect. So it's actually a little bit more like maybe the Lost Vikings, which is also kind of obscure and 30 years old, but you move one character and then you can switch to the other character and he's way back there and you can make him catch up with the other character. But it's not like Trine where you control one character and they basically transform into each other.
No.
You control all three characters, but you only control one at a time.
Really, like the game that this resembles the most is Maniac Mansion, where the characters would all have some slight differences. For instance, only like the nerd could hack a computer, or only the punk girl could put a hamster in a microwave. But you know, other than that,
only like, she is punk enough to do that.
Yeah,
I'm interested more from the story perspective of mechanisms by which to deliver a story.
It is very like separate stories, and you're not really, when you choose your characters initially, you're not really creating a team. Like, you're really creating a series of levels that you're going to play through this one time through the game.
To me, though, what I mean is, it's interesting that their primary mechanism of delivering story content is either the narrator or just through experiential puzzles. It's different and somewhat, I mean, I don't want to use the phrase experimental because that makes me sound like a pretentious asshole. But it's an interesting thing to try. I'm curious, how well does it work? Like, how well do you feel you know these characters once you complete a playthrough with them?
Initially, I wasn't sure exactly what the game was doing. And the more I played, the more I was enjoying it. And actually, my second playthrough, I started really, really liking the game. My opinion of the game really only went up, even though technically, I was doing some of the things that I had already been doing. You know, like, there's overlap, you know, like the generic sections of the game, of the cave, you're going to be doing over and over again, and they don't change. You're doing the same puzzles you've already solved, and usually I really hate that, but I was so into discovering who these characters were that I really was more and more impressed with the game.
So that's an interesting connection to the games we both played recently, the Zero Escape games.
Yeah, well,
because you replay, well, I know. But I mean, you do replay some of the same parts of the game, primarily driven by the motivation to learn about the characters.
Yeah, but you're not, like, unlike 999, you're not learning more and more about this one overall story. Here, you're really just discovering a new character, and then another character.
Right.
And I don't know why, I think Ron Gilbert perhaps is a little bit of a dick, because there's there's seven characters to play as. You can only take three with you, so you have to play the game at least three times to see all of their stories. They both have a good and a bad ending, so quick math, like, you have to go through the game five times if you want to see them all.
And it goes back to the old, there are 20 seats on the school bus and 42 kids, how many school buses do you need? Problem.
In this case, I think now the good and bad endings, I don't know much about that, but I have a feeling it's probably not worth playing through again just to see a different you know, a slightly different ending at the, you know, maybe you just go to YouTube and watch the one you didn't get.
Right.
But in terms of, I know a lot of people are complaining about the kind of odd number of characters, and the fact that you can only take three at a time. I think actually it's very intentional, and I don't think it's because he's a dick. I think it's probably got to do with the fact that some of the generic puzzles do require special abilities. And because on any given playthrough, they don't know which combination of characters you've chosen, they've designed it in such a way that as long as there are seven characters, there's enough overlap in the different special powers that they have that the math works out so that they know that you've picked at least one or two characters who are going to be able to get you through those overlapping puzzles. So I think it's actually more of a math issue, and I think it's probably done very intentionally.
I'm not so sure, though, because the generic parts so far, I haven't really encountered obstacles that couldn't be solved in another way. Like, I've seen some hooks that the adventurer can use. She's got a grappling hook, but usually you can just jump to those places anyway. Or, yeah, I can't really think.
That's the thing. There's more than one way to solve the puzzle. As long as you have the adventurer or another character or a third character, you can get through it. And because of the number of characters and the number that they make you choose, so in other words, you couldn't play the game through with only two. You have to have three. And because there are seven total, the math works out so that they know that no matter what combination you choose, you have to have at least one of the powers that will let you get through
that section.
You avoid
the deadlock, effectively.
Yes. I think it is it's a trick that they're using to make sure that you don't get stuck at a puzzle where you don't have the right character.
They could have had you move around four characters, or, you know, like...
I think that would be worse, because I think the fact that you're carrying around three characters is probably the worst thing about this game.
Yeah.
It's neat, but... And some of the puzzles make clever use of you having more than one person. They have to work together somehow, or they're separated like you talked about. But overall, just moving around and like carrying things, I find becomes kind of annoying, you know, because the characters move slowly, especially the way they climb up and down ropes and ladders is very, very slow, and you can't just jump down, because if you fall too far you die, which has no consequence except you just have to do it over again.
Yeah.
And when they give you like three items and they make all three of your characters pick up these items, and now you have to carry them over here, that means you have to actually move all three characters separately. So that just traversing this little stretch of the cave takes three times longer than it should. But it's stupid. There should be a way to like make them group up and control all three at the same time, or just push a button and have the other two guys warp to your current location. I mean,
I don't disagree that this is a problem, kind of a design problem, but for some reason I mind it less and less as I go through, probably because, you know, those generic areas of the game, I've already solved one, so I know what's required, so I don't do as many needless movements. Like, I don't move around.
You've already gone through the trial and error, and you can just do it efficiently the second time.
Yeah, so I don't mind it as much anymore.
But it's still a problem.
There's also some things that are fun is, you know, like, sometimes when you've got a certain character, you can get certain items that you wouldn't get otherwise, and they can allow you to bypass whole sections of the cave. Like, if you've got, I think, the scientist or the monk, I can't remember, you can get a hot dog very early on in the game. If you carry that all the way to a certain area, you bypass a whole section of the game where you need to get a hot dog. You save a lot of time that way. So there's some cool stuff that you can discover like that on repeated playthroughs.
The old hot dog bypass trick.
That's worked for me back in college.
And by bypass, I mean triple bypass from eating too many hot dogs.
That's not what I mean, James.
Oh.
Well, it is a pretty interesting game. I haven't played a whole lot of it yet, but you know, I have issues with it, but I also, there are things that I definitely like about it so far. And I think, you know, it's probably the, well, Puddle just came out today, I guess. I've never gotten a sense that Puddle is a really great game either. I think The Cave probably has more to recommend. And, you know, it's a fairly lengthy game. It has a lot of replay value, obviously. And if you're looking for something to do on your Wii U, I think you could do a lot worse than The Cave for $15.
Just one final warning. I mean, the game looks like a platformer. As a puzzle, as a classic adventure fan and platformer fan, I got to say that only one aspect is satisfying, and it's the puzzles.
Yeah, it's not a good platformer.
At all. So
it's a shatformer?
Wow.
A scatformer?
Coining. Coin and James.
Yeah.
The platformer is just a means to an end. Like, it's just to solve the issue of finding a good way to deliver these puzzles with to someone who's got, like, a controller in his hands instead of a mouse.
Right. It's basically, like, a arguably superior option to pointing and clicking with a joystick.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is not good either. So. No. I'm not sure which one is really better, but neither is a very good solution. But anyway, let's move on. John, what was your new business this week?
This week I played a retro game called Let's Watch My 360 Red Ring. It was a really good time.
This was really popular about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, it was big. It was big back then.
We did a whole, like, running segment on it.
Yep. Yeah, so, you know, I thought the thing is just to trace the history of my 360s. I originally had a Launch 360.
Note the plurals nature of his
thing. Yes. The one I brought home from the store originally, it was DOA with a bad hard drive. Took it back to the store, got another one. That worked for a while. I sold that one. I saw the train coming down the tracks. Sold that one on eBay and got one of
Not
the,
my problem!
Yeah, I got one of the 120 gig, elites. And I figured, all right, so they probably got most of the problems licked. I should be good. Well, I was good for probably about maybe 3 or 4 years, just enough for it to slip outside a warranty, because with the Red Ring stuff, I think the rule is if it's 3 years past your date of purchase, they won't cover it. So, and I'm probably actually just past that. I think I bought this in like maybe 2009, 2008. I'm not too sure. I'm not too far outside of that warranty for the Red Ring stuff.
Yeah, I would like to point out predictive hardware failures. That's awesome.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I thought this thing, and you know, what bugs me now. What happened to me was it just started to freeze up, and I couldn't really.
Yeah.
Just completely out of nowhere, it just started to freeze, and you know, I shut it down. Like I was in game, just froze. You know, shut it down. I figured maybe it's some sort of like Xbox Live issue that's causing it to freeze up or causing it to hang.
Sure, this happens all the time on Wii U.
Yeah, well, I was like, I didn't think it would Red Ring.
Maybe
my
Wii U infected my 360.
Yeah, I mean, the console's been pretty good so far. Booted up again, it froze again. Shut it down.
So did you ever get the crazy graphical glitches?
No, I never got that, and that's what I figured. That's what I figured I would see. That's what, because you get like that sort of checkerboard look, right?
Yeah,
isn't that what you get? Yeah.
So,
and I never got those.
With the Last Remnant, it just refused to load textures, which is actually what the Last Remnant does anyway. So it's hard to tell. But then it would just load them with like inverted color palettes and bullshit. Like, whoa, this looks awesome.
So I'm not too sure what this is, because that was happening because wasn't it the graphics graphics card on board was actually warping the main board.
Yes, it was.
So I don't think this is the case with me. I think maybe like the RAM is gone or something like that, because this thing, it just freezes randomly. Like it'll freeze sometimes on boot up. But the thing is, what happened was I had to keep rebooting it, and then eventually the three Red Rings, and I was like, I was like, great, fucking Red Ring. Are you kidding me? So, you know, I kept rebooting it, and sometimes it would work and I would be able to get in game, and then it would freeze and I'd reboot it and it would Red Ring. And I was like, oh God, here we go. So it's going to cost me $100 to replace it. Now, the thing is with that is I'm hesitant to do that because chances are, I mean, the next Xbox is just around the corner. It's going to be backwards compatible, I'm sure, in some capacity. So it's just a hell of a time for me to want to replace this console, you know? Like, I don't want to sink any more money into it.
So here's the thing, though. Remember what the 360's backwards compatibility was like, which is to say what
awful.
It wasn't like.
Yeah, it was awful. You're right. I don't know. You know, a friend of mine at work is like, I don't use my 360. I'll sell it to you for $50. But do I want another legacy console, like, kicking around here? Not really.
Drake of the 99 Dragons is backwards compatible.
Yeah.
But Halo 2 wasn't. Just think about that.
Yeah, really. So, yeah. So that's my kind of tale of woe, which kind of bothers me. But hopefully the next round of consoles will be a bit better. I think Microsoft has gotten burned too much and spent too much money to let their next console die like this.
Well, you know, a lot of people think that the new Xbox that is probably coming out this fall will not be backwards compatible with 360 because the internal architecture will be so different.
Well,
so
yeah.
So does that kind of lead you towards thinking about trying to pick up like maybe like a cheap used replacement 360?
I might, you know.
You might want to pick up all the cheap used replacement 360s. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, what I could see them doing with the next Xbox is just saying, you know, any games instead of having, you know, hardware backwards, well, not hard, but basically putting older games, just putting them online so you can download them.
Like, well, they not did even that with the original it. Xbox.
Yeah.
But they only put a handful of them out there in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, 360 uses software emulation for the original Xbox.
Yeah.
But even that is kind of imperfect, and it doesn't support every game. And, I mean, if what we're hearing is true, that would be the best case scenario for the next one.
Yep.
So, you know, the games that you own may or may not work on the new system, and there's every possibility they may just say, screw it, you know, we sold 100 million Xbox 360s. If you want to play a 360 game, go get one. They're not hard to get. Everybody's got two already. Yeah. So
can I give you a conspiracy theory? Y'all ready for this?
No.
Good. The Xbox 360 replacement and the PlayStation replacement won't be backwards compatible because that gives you something to play on your shiny new console. It doesn't involve you buying new games. And
I've heard that argument before.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard that backwards compatibility hurts new consoles.
And the software attach rate on a new console is tremendously important for getting third parties on board.
Hey, it's hurt. I tell you what, in a very real way, it has hurt the number of games I bought for Wii U because I'm still playing Wii games on my Wii U.
Yeah,
there you go.
But as far as most people are concerned, I think that, you know, like, they're not even aware that games came out in the last 2 years on the Wii.
It don't have to come out in the last 2 years. It's something you can play on it.
When you turn on Wii U, there's a thing there that says Wii Channel. And if you click on it, it will tell you what it does.
Yeah, but I mean...
So it's not like
I know, that's not... I guess I was trolling about the drought.
he was saying no games came out on the Wii since 2010. Alright, but my point though, Gilm, is that just the fact that you could pull a Wii game off your shelf, even if it is from 2010, and stick it in your Wii U and start playing, prevents me from going out and buying bullshit like NBA 2K12 or 13, whatever it's called, which I'm about to shit on when I get to my segment of new business.
Yeah.
So
it gives me the freedom to be choosier about the Wii U games that I buy.
Well, right. You know that you already have
because
something
I'm not
in the
desperate
pocket
for
you,
something to
you,
play on.
Exactly, you can play. You can play something.
Yep.
So, yeah. Now, I did also get a copy of Hyrule Historia, but I haven't looked at it yet, so I didn't.
I did too, yeah. I flipped through it. It looks nice.
Yep.
But it's a big-ass book, and I got it yesterday. I just have not had time to spend with it. But it looks pretty cool. I mean, it probably weighs 10 pounds. Like, it's an impressive piece of paper.
Yep.
You know, it is a coffee table book, for sure. Really nice, hardbound. You know, full color pages. I was surprised there's not more kind of like full page artwork. I guess it feels more like a textbook in the, you know, like in the size of the art that's in there. So it's a lot of smaller images with text to go with them to kind of describe them. I was kind of expecting more of like one of those art books you get with a collector's edition where you just have full page color artwork, you know.
Yeah.
It's not quite like that. It's more of a... It is kind of more like a reference book.
Well, I do wonder, though, how much of that art actually exists, because a lot of the artwork they did back in the day was just for covers of game cartridges and for inside of instruction manuals.
And you make a good point. I don't really think there's that much original art in this book. I think it is stuff that already existed in the course of developing these classic games. And that's what it's for. I mean, it is Hyrule Historia. Like, it is a history book. It's essentially the book of the history of the Zelda series. And so it's not necessarily meant to be this kind of show off. I don't know. It's fan service, but it's maybe more educational than you might expect from fan service. You know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah. So just real quick, did everybody who gets this book immediately flip to the timeline? Is that pretty much standard procedure?
I flipped at it to laugh at it, and it is kind of laughable.
It is kind of multi-level insane.
I'd be curious to just see how they actually lay it out, because it's been obliterated generally.
I think every person who gets that book, one of the very first things they do is flips the timeline. Because everybody knows it's there, so they just jump right to it.
I was just curious. It's not why I bought the book, but I was curious as to how they presented it. And it's actually not even... presented in the most straightforward, clear to read format.
No, there's some alternative timeline stuff going on, and it gets kind of weird to read. I did notice all the places where they put marks for things that have never been covered in a game, like, oh, there's going to be a game there, and there's going to be a game there. like they get to like War of Hyrule Unification. It's like, What? They've never even mentioned that before.
That's for the upcoming Zelda Dynasty Warriors crossover.
I would buy that game. I would buy a thousand... Made by Koei and published by LJN. Yes.
Damn straight. So I'll go next with new business. I really haven't gotten to play a whole lot of stuff. I had a friend in town, and he's not much of a gamer, and he just wasn't really interested. I did steal away enough time to play about 3 hours of Ni No Kuni, which I actually took an entire evening just to download it on my PS3 because it's fucking huge, and the PSN store is really slow with downloads. It's similar to Wii U. And so I didn't get to play it the day it came out, even though I started downloading it that night. But Ni No Kuni is just ridiculously good looking. It is a very straightforward JRPG in a lot of ways. Although it's not overly simplistic by any means. It has a lot of systems. It has a lot of characters. The magic system is really interesting. And the story that they set up is surprisingly complex. I think the world that they throw you into has a lot of interesting things going on, and the characters, even early in the game, the characters are just really interesting that you run into. So all that stuff is good, although you would find that in most, you know, sort of traditional JRPGs. I think the refreshing thing is this kind of game just doesn't really get made anymore. It is so traditional. I mean, it is very similar in a lot of ways to like a Dragon Quest VIII. It's made by some of the same people, of course. The art style is even in the same realm as Dragon Quest, although it's far more detailed and far more beautiful. But, you know, if you like the way Dragon Quest looks, I think you will appreciate very much how Ni No Kuni looks and vice versa, even though this does look much better. But it's a friggin' JRPG, and it's a big, you know, super expensive, very long, complex console JRPG, which almost is extinct at this point. And I think that's probably the main reason that people are so excited about it. And I can't speak to all of that stuff because I'm still so early in the game. It's still giving me a lot of tutorials about, you know, how this or that part of the combat works, etc. You know, there is a really cool Pokemon element to it, although I haven't actually learned how to collect monsters yet. I only have the starter familiar that you get. But you can level him up, and I think he eventually evolves, and, you know, it's Pokemon enough. But the main thing I just have to comment on is the presentation, because that's the first thing you notice. And, you know, I am a fan of Studio Ghibli stuff. I'm a fan of Miyazaki's movies, most of them, not all of them. But the fidelity with which that studio's style is captured in a 3D world presented in this interactive game is absolutely stunning. And I think this is a game that, much like Wind Waker, and I have been thinking about Wind Waker a lot this week as I play Ni No Kuni, and not just because of the HD remake announced last week, but I think they are striking in a similar way, even though the actual art style is quite different between the two, but it looks like you're playing a cartoon. And it looks like you're playing a super high quality, like Disney cartoon, you know, and the Ghibli movies are distributed by Disney and localized by Disney in the West. And I think you get a very similar feel. It feels like this is something Japanese that someone like John Lasseter fell in love with and decided that he needed to bring to the rest of the world, and took as much care as he could possibly afford to do a fantastic translation, bring in great voice actors, make sure all the music was, you know, brought over, and to really try to sell this to a Western audience. And he's not hiding the fact that it's very Japanese. He's celebrating it, but he's presenting it in such a way that we can appreciate it, and that it's very accessible and easy for us to get into. And that's exactly how I feel about Ni No Kuni. And like the Miyazaki movies that Disney brings over, I think it's something that even someone who's normally not interested in anime, or in this case, maybe even someone who's not interested in video games, will look at this and be almost immediately enraptured by it, because it is so beautiful and innocent and adorable, and it just looks absolutely stunning. And when you realize that it is all in real time, and that you can actually swing the camera around and control the characters, it is very, very similar. I mean, it takes me back to the first time I played Wind Waker, and I spent like 5 minutes staring at the sky and the clouds and the wisps of wind blowing by and the birds flying overhead, because I'd never seen anything that looked that awesome. And Ni No Kuni has the same effect on me. It just it's absolutely incredible looking. It's a game that's going to age so well over the years because there's really nothing else that looks like it right now. And even if there are a lot of copycats, which I doubt because it probably costs a fortune to make the game look like this, this will always be the first. And nothing about this game is going to age in terms of visuals. So that alone to me has made me extremely glad that I picked it up. And I'm loving it so far, absolutely loving it. But I'm 3 hours into a 50-hour game, so it's hard for me to talk about the depth or how it wears on you over time. But man, that game makes a hell of a first impression.
So, well, my only concern, I want to get the game, and I will eventually once I actually play the RPGs that I have right now. But I do kind of worry about the game wearing me down eventually. Like, you've mentioned Dragon Quest VIII, and that's actually one of my least favorite Dragon Quest games, just because I think that the grinding in the game was more prevalent, like, it was more necessary, and while the world was beautiful to explore, it got really tedious for me. But the game ended up being, like, 70 hours long, and if you were to try to get the actual, like, the ultimate ending, it would take you perhaps, like, over 100 hours.
Took me over 100. I loved every minute of it. So you and I are coming from different places on this issue, because I have a much higher tolerance for grinding. And if I like the way the game looks, and if I'm excited about exploring the world and sort of exploiting all the different gameplay systems that they throw at you, I can play a game like this for as long as they will let me. And that's I'm actually looking forward to that stuff.
One thing that the game has for it, though, is that it does not have random encounters, right?
That's true. It's more like it's probably best comparison is like Earthbound or Chrono Trigger, because you see the enemies on the map, and generally they will run at you or approach you as you get close. So you can only run away from them sometimes. It kind of depends on how far away they are and how quickly they notice you.
Right.
But you at least have a chance. And I think at least having the opportunity and the chance to run away and avoid battle when you don't want to battle has a huge psychological difference, even if you end up fighting them anyway most of the time.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Chrono Trigger is the same way. There are a lot of places in Chrono Trigger where there's an enemy in your way and you're not getting past him without fighting him.
Yeah.
But there are chances, at least every now and then, for you to kind of go around an enemy if you're clever, if you pay attention. And that is very much the case in Ni No Kuni. So when you do, it feels good and probably doesn't make that much difference in the end, but at least you feel like you have some agency in the matter. And it's not like they're just kind of punishing you for walking, which is, I know that's how people feel about a lot of JRPGs.
I've started Dragon Quest VI. The random encounter rate is ridiculous so far.
You realize like how old school that is and why it was kind of done away with.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Dragon Quest is famous for that. I mean, they've always had really high random encounter rates, and people put up with it, or some people maybe even like it, but it is part of the DNA.
Yeah,
of
I mean, the thing is, it's stuck around for a long time. I mean, it's going back into like the early 80s. Like that was, with games like I was playing Ultima, the first Ultima, and that's exactly what it is. You're wandering around a map getting randomly attacked.
And back then it was technological limits. Yeah. Like they couldn't actually show enough characters on the screen for you to see the enemies before you approach them. And so that's why there's kind of had this fictional conceit of they snuck up on you or whatever. They were hiding in the woods. But now if you make a modern RPG and you make it so that you have these sort of invisible random encounters, you're really just kind of being anachronistic, because there's no reason you couldn't show that enemy wandering around. So I think it's good that Ni No Kuni handles it in the way that they do.
I think it's good that John has unboxed his disket of Ultima.
Yeah. Well, technically, that's the whole thing.
Ultima 1.
I got it off of Good Old Game, so technically I didn't have to unbox it. See, that's it. if you remove that step, you don't have to do it.
He got it off Good Old Games, and the website was called Good New Games.
Oh.
Wow.
So I'm looking forward to playing many dozens more hours of Ni No Kuni, but I do friggin' love it so far. So the only other thing I wanted to talk about this week is not even a game, but it's something I think people will be interested in. I downloaded a digital copy of the first issue of Nintendo Force, which is the magazine that Lucas Thomas and a lot of other Nintendo writers have sort of gotten together, and they're kind of doing it almost, I think even almost like volunteer or making probably almost no money, I'm not sure. But they're getting together and trying to basically replace Nintendo Power.
I think they're doing it for no money, and all the revenue that they get is for Child's Play.
That's what I was thinking too. I don't know if maybe that's only the first issue. I don't know if they're going to do that forever, because there's so much work put into this. It's really well done.
And people still pirate it, by the way.
Do they really? That's awful.
Yep.
But they've done such a good job on this, and I paid $5 for it, which I think is a totally reasonable price to pay for a digital magazine. You can get a print copy. It's really expensive. It's like $18, so it's kind of like Killscreen, the magazine that John likes.
Yeah.
But that's because they're printing it on demand. So they don't print 10,000 copies and then send them out to newsstands. This is only made for the people who actually prepay for it. So when you pay your $18, some company that they've chosen will print out a copy just for you and mail it directly to you, and that's why it's so expensive. And they're looking at options to bring that price down over time, I think. Mm-hmm. But I was totally fine with the digital copy, of course, and I'm actually reading it on my iPhone little by little in the Kindle app, which is has a good interface for reading PDFs. And I say little by little because it's really long. It's 80 pages long, the first issue, with no ads. So that's almost all content. There's a few pages that are like, really big full-page artwork. And some of it's really good. Some of it's artwork like of stuff like Luigi's Mansion that I haven't actually seen this artwork before. So I don't know if they got it exclusively from Nintendo or if they just dug it up. And maybe because I don't read other magazines, maybe that's why I haven't seen it. But the magazine is laid out very professionally. The writing is very, very good. It's well edited. And I don't say that lightly, because a lot of magazines are not well edited. A lot of websites are not edited at all. And I don't include ours in that, of course. But they've done a very, very good job of it. And I can't compare it to Nintendo Power, because I didn't read Nintendo Power the past few years. So I don't know what condition that magazine was in before it went away. But this is really impressive work. And I think if you love Nintendo Power, if you just love the idea of there being a Nintendo magazine, unofficial or not, this is not a fan project. This is not a fanboy project. This is really professionally done, and it's very impressive. And I think, it's definitely worth supporting. There's a ton of content in here, lots of reviews. There's like 40 pages of previews for stuff throughout all of 2013 on all the Nintendo platforms. They did a good, there's a good virtual console roundup of a lot of stuff that's come out recently on that. I go back and look at some older games that aren't even on virtual console, like, Neil did an article on Goof Troop for, Super Nintendo, which is the first, Shinji Mikami game.
And the scariest.
The scariest one. There's just a lot of really cool stuff that, it's all original content. It's written just for the magazine. And I think they did a fantastic job. And there's even a 2-page spread devoted to Birdo. And you won't find that in EGM.
I can respect that. I can totally respect that.
Like swimsuit edition spread or what?
Yeah, swimsuit edition, exactly.
Oh, okay.
Centerfold.
Nintendo Force, I'm really surprised and impressed at the quality of it. And I think people should really check it out. It's online. Like I said, you can buy the PDF for $5 or spend a lot more and get a print copy. But either way, it's the same content. And I think they're planning to do a new issue every 2 months. There's so much stuff in here I think 2 months is a very reasonable amount of time to wait for the next one. It'll probably take me that long just to read through this, because I only read a couple pages a day. But it's very, very good. And that's all from me, so let's wrap it up with James.
Right. Last week I was planning on talking about having played Gunman Clive. At the time, we had frozen up on me literally right before we started playing. In a boss fight where it just kept repeating the sound of me shooting at the boss and the boss shooting back at me, even though he was dead.
Oh, that would not be annoying at all.
It was awesome. I sat there for like a minute to give the game a chance to recover its shit. It never did. There has been a patch, yes. That was super not fun. There has, I've cleared the game. I've gotten through a significant portion of the game as the duck, which which is not awesome, to be honest. Duck could be better. I know everybody on the show really likes Gunman Clive, and I respect that. But to me, the game was told as like, oh, this is like Mega Man. You need to get on this. But it just feels kind of slow. I don't know if it's because there's not much enemies on screen at any one time or because Clive himself is kind of a floaty jumper and doesn't really go very far. I don't know. Mm. It feels...
I mean, yeah, it does have a slow pace to it, but I don't feel like his jumping is floaty.
Floaty's not the word I'm looking for, but it's like he's on Mars. I mean,
it's deliberate.
He's in the air a long time when he jumps.
He does have some hang. I think part of it, he just jumps so high that it takes long time for him to come back down.
Yeah, I don't know. It just feels kind of weird when he does that. I don't know. But for me, I mean, it's an okay game. I mean, I enjoyed it well enough. I don't know that I would hold it up against any Mega Man game, because unless it's not made by Capcom, it's going to lose, or we're talking about the power battle.
How does it compare to, say, Mega Man versus Street Fighter?
I would prefer Mega Man versus Street Fighter, actually, because that plays like a Mega Man game. But, I mean, to me, it just felt like there weren't enough enemies on screen at any one point. The game itself was never really difficult. It was like, here's one enemy. He shoots in a pattern. Bloop. Bloop.
Yeah, I would say it's actually kind of similar to Mutant Muds in that respect, because it's not about overwhelming you with enemies. It's that every encounter with an enemy is set up to be unique. So whether it's maybe the enemy is higher than you are, and so you have to jump up to hit him, and then that means you have to time between his shots.
Yeah, or, to an extent.
You know, maybe it's because he's hiding behind a box, and you have a limited span of time in which to get him. But it is very much set up on a one-by-one series of conflict. So it is very much like these series of almost like duels between you and the next enemy.
Yeah, and I do wish he moved faster, because it's more like gently strolling through the park on a Sunday afternoon, Clive. I'm like, dude, you are being fucking shot at. You should move faster.
Well, he never really moves his head either. He's always just that kind of chill, brim of the hat down. He's just a cool cat. Gunman Clive, he's a cool cat.
It's like neck brace Halo Clive. Yeah, I don't know. It's okay. I enjoyed it for what it was. I'm not attached to it. The only reason I even attempted to play with the duck, I'm like, well, then how the hell are they going to have you play as the duck? And then I realized, oh, they're just going to make it so you can't shoot. Awesome. And you can sort of fly like you're Kirby.
Yeah, it's Kirby's a good example. It turns it into an evasive game, so you're just trying to get around enemies.
Yeah, and ultimately, it's pretty much trial and error as the duck. You're just like, all right, how far can I fly on this jump? All right, get over this guy's head and just keep walking.
I'm actually kind of hoping, you know, now that the developer has already patched the game once, I'm kind of hoping he's going to try to do maybe some DLC or something to add some additional content to it. Or I've heard that the game's actually sold better on 3DS than it did on iOS.
Yep.
Like he's made more, or at least he's made more money on it, whatever that means. So that's very encouraging. Because I really enjoy it. I want him to do more stuff.
The weapon power-ups I like, but they just don't give them to you very much. Or when they do, they give them to you in places where like, okay, awesome, this doesn't help me out that much, thanks.
Because they're a little bit random.
Yeah,
they are
which random.
One you get. And there's a couple of them that are really good, and then there's a couple of them you're just like, okay, you're going to spread my shots out. Well, the only one that's going to hit is the one going straight anyway, because there's only one guy to shoot.
Yeah, but just get closer.
So I can hit him three times? Yeah. He's still going to die.
Well, for bosses, it can be useful.
This isn't draw buttholes on his face, Clive.
The try shot's useful because it lets you attack enemies from a different angle.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. That's part of the design too is the fact that you have to be at a certain angle. Like you can't just like the first thing I wondered when I started playing was, well, can I aim up and down? Well, no, you can't. So you have to kind of adjust the way you play the game to account for that.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't find that it. I was really met with a significant amount of challenge. And anytime I did run into an area that presented difficulty, it was usually just because it was like, it was a weird angle they presented me with, and I'm like, well,
yeah. All right, or you had to kind of figure out the timing, like, oh, okay, well, I have to run forward on the screen before, you know, instead of just letting it scroll naturally or whatever.
Right.
Isn't there a hard mode? Isn't there a difficulty select?
There is a difficulty select. It just you just take more damage.
Oh, okay. I didn't actually try it.
Yeah. It's not appreciably more difficult that I can perceive. You just die easier. Yeah, I don't know. I'm actually playing the duck on hard mode because what the fuck difference does it make? But yeah, so I mean, really, that's it for me on Gunman Clive. I don't think I'm ever gonna go back to finish the duck because eh. I also played the demo for whatever Brain Training is called in the U.S.
Yeah, I did too.
that is a bad demo.
Yeah, yeah.
It's basically we're gonna give you a math problem, solve it, but don't write your answer now. Write it when the next math problem comes up. Which is really easy. Then it gets to 2, which is also really easy. Then it gets to 3, and your brain goes, oh, fuck. And then just stops.
The level 3 is fucking impossible.
Yeah. It really is. There's actually a physiological reason why that's hard for the brain at 3, but I'm not going to get into that.
Yeah.
I played the demo for, as I mentioned, the NBA Wii U game, which is terrible.
Mm.
So it's an enormous demo. It takes forever to fucking download. Which is great because there's almost no presentation value in it whatsoever. There's an opening cinematic that shows the arena you're playing at, and then there's a bunch of really badly rendered faces of real NBA players, which is really inexcusable because you're dealing with a limited set of players, and the reason you buy these games is to play as those players. This isn't the NFL where they're behind a face mask. The reason the NBA is marketable is because you can see the face of the players. So for the love of God, don't make Russell Westbrook look like an action figure. It's not that hard. And it's Wii U tablet integration. Gamepad, excuse me. I'm going to get a nasty gram now. It's gamepad integration. Is you get the same action as on the TV screen, except you don't really. You get like heat vision version of it so you can see how tired people are. It's presented by Powerade.
Are you serious?
Something like that, yeah.
Powerade vision.
That's like a dagger to the heart.
So it's got electrolytes.
All you get are it looks it. Do you remember the scene from the Predator movies where it was like everything was just color shapes to show where the heat is? It's
got
like
time
that.
To bleed.
That's all you get. That is what you get on the tablet. It's awful. It's so bad.
Is there any use to it, or is it just a weird display?
It's stupid,
thing?
Worthless.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably something that could just simply be done with a meter above your player's
head. That's how they've always done it. So what they usually did was they had a, you know, there's a little icon around the player to show, you know, the different players, and they just had a color code on them. As they get tired, it turns red.
Yep.
They had the tablet and said, fuck, I don't know how to use this thing.
Like, I give them credit for doing something creative with it. It sounds like it wasn't actually a good idea, but at least it's not a map of the basketball court.
The hot dog stand is right here.
But, I mean, you could use the tablet to, like, call out plays and stuff. It'd be so much easier than with the absolutely asinine button combinations you have to press on this game.
They probably just didn't have time to implement it, and they just wanted to port it over or whatever, just use their existing engine.
So,
yeah,
because
that was a launch game.
Yeah, so the time thing. The hit stick, or whatever they call the stupid thing, is the opposite control.
They should call it the foul stick.
Yeah, there you go. Well, there's the control stick that's not the one that moves your character. They talk about it in the opening video for the demo for like 8,000 hours. And ultimately, it just lets you dribble fancy and shoot. The problem is, it's the same thing to dribble fancy and or shoot, which makes not a lot of sense because in both cases, the same person is going to be doing them. It's like, do you want to shoot now? Do you want to dribble now? I don't know, game. Which one do I want to do? You tell me. So I just use the buttons for shooting and never bothered to juke around dribbling because why bother? It's awesome. This is a crappy demo. And then the last demo I played, which isn't a crappy demo, so I actually got around to playing the Fire Emblem Awakening, officially now, demo in the eShop for the 3DS.
Who the hell saw the gushing reviews coming from everywhere?
If I had played this demo ahead of time, I would have.
It is incredible. Everyone loves it.
So, I know we've talked about the demo a little bit on the show, but I would guess I'm probably the most experienced Fire Emblem player on the show. Played 4, I think. Maybe 5 of them. You know, I've mostly stayed away from this game. I don't know why. Like, I haven't really followed it very much in the media. You know, I never got around to buying Shadow Dragon, even though I kept telling myself I would.
The reviews out of Japan last year were fabulous.
Yeah.
So
I was aware.
I wasn't that surprised to hear, you know, that it was getting great scores.
Wow,
here.
This thing has a 91 overall.
Yeah. Yeah. So
Metacritic, 91.
The very first thing I noticed when the game starts, it shows. So a lot of the Fire Emblem games, especially the more recent ones, have had you as a character in the game, but you're never shown. You're just the tactician, and you're referred to as such. But you're not actually a thing in the game. You're just sort of an abstract concept that people talk to occasionally.
Right.
In this one, you actually have to create your character. And the first thing you see at the beginning is the Create a Character screen, although you can't really do much because the demo has it all locked down. And the very first thing I noticed was, oh my god, these character models look amazing. And that may not seem like a huge significant thing, but you have to understand, every Fire Emblem character throughout the series history has worn red, blue, or green. And that's it. That's all they've ever done. And suddenly you have these really richly decorated character models that reminded me instantly of, like, the character models from the Crystal Chronicles games. I mean, they look like Lilty characters. And I was like, wow, that's kind of cool. And as you go into the battlefield, everything presentation-wise has gone up 10 levels from any Fire Emblem game to date.
But don't you think it's worth mentioning that once you're actually on the battle screen, you know, and you're looking at the grid that you move your characters around on, they're still sprites. Like,
they are. They are.
It kind of looks like a GBA game when you're not in a cutscene.
But see, the thing is, even that looks better than any game prior in the series. I mean,
well, yeah, because I mean the GBA game that we played for Retroactive, not a good looking game.
I mean,
it's very kind of industrial looking, you know, very crude looking sprites. So yeah, they added some detail to it, but it's like, I think it's weird that they went through the trouble to, you know, build these really nice looking character models in 3D, and you know, especially the fact that you're playing on a 3D system that actually shows 3D graphics, and then on the battle screen, it just kind of looks like a Super Nintendo or a GBA game all over again with these sprites.
The problem with the battle screen is that it has to be overhead. And
yeah.
It's hard to squeeze a lot of detail on an overhead view without it just looking cluttered.
They did a pretty good job on the GameCube and Wii games.
They did.
Is not entirely overhead. It's a little more bird's eye, I guess. You know, it's like tilted back enough that you can kind of see the three-dimensionality of the character models.
I think it's supposed to be like you're playing the game on a map. I mean, you're still the tactician. I mean, that's still your role in the game, although you actually take part in combat, which is kind of interesting. So you can get your Mary Sue character out there to be a total badass. But also, your character is a total badass. Oh my god. But I was just taken aback by how nice the game looks. And Story-wise, you know, you don't start out with Ike playing with a wooden sword getting his ass beat by his father. I mean, right off the bat, shit's got real. It's...
Well, in the demo, at least.
Well, the demo is the opening, the training segment in Chapter 1.
Oh, okay.
It actually, because all the Fire Emblem games have a Chapter 0, they don't usually call it that, they usually call it, like, Prologue or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have Chapter 1, and that's what it is, it's Prologue and Chapter 1. And, you know, you can tell that they've just really pushed this game up a level. And I always thought the Fire Emblem series had a bad rap. Like, it's a really good series. It has really solid gameplay mechanics. It's so uninviting. And visually, it was always a little bit harsh. I mean, some of the character artwork was always really nice, but it always just looked bland and relatively uninteresting because of the limited color palette. The character models all kind of look the same. Obviously, the biggest change they made gameplay-wise is they really bumped up the relationship capacity. I mean, that existed in the old Fire Emblem games. Characters could grow to like each other more. But they combined that with altering the ride ability to actually partner the characters together so they complement each other rather than one person providing another one a ride across the battlefield. And they got rid of the character death. I mean, you can still turn it on if you want. But they've made it optional, and apparently as your characters mature, they influence future characters' role in the world. It's like they added things to the core gameplay mechanic that I already thought was really good, and to be honest, somewhat underrated. And I think they found the magic ingredients to take what was already a really solid gameplay and very instantly, I can see that this is the best Fire Emblem game I've ever played. In two chapters.
From the demo?
From the demo. And I love this series. I absolutely adore it.
And but, you haven't like, even married characters yet.
I haven't.
Yeah, that was the crazy. I read Scott's review today. If the characters build up a good enough relationship, they can get married and have kids, and the kids become playable characters.
Yes. What? That's fucking bonkers. What the hell? I'm picking this shit up. I can tell you that right now. After hearing James, seeing the reviews and hearing that wacky ass shit, I am picking this up. That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm with you, John. I'm totally downloading this on Sunday. Yeah. I mean, this might... Are you interested in this, having played, you know, a few other ones?
Again, my backlog is holding me back. I want to finish Sacred Stones. I still haven't. And I want to finish Path of Radiance. And I have Radiant Dawn waiting for me.
Nice.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, this might be the first time that all four of us will have a brand new game the week it comes out and talk about it on the show. Yeah. But that may not happen.
Well, it looks like I have no choice. Okay, you're twisting my arm. I will get the game.
It just seems like they made relatively small tweaks to the series and produced, you know, a much more approachable and much more desirable game product. And it looks so much better, and just playing it, it felt faster, even though it could all be in my head. And, you know, the characters all seemed interesting from the very beginning, except for this archer you meet who just seems like a really annoying person, but, you know, he'll just get to live in the party. And there's menu options that seem enticing about at the base. You can see what your party is doing. It's like, what does that mean? I don't know. I'm just excited to play this game. And it's cool, considering before I downloaded the demo, I really had no expectations whatsoever.
Nice.
I'm pleased.
That's a good demo.
And now you have your 2013 game of the year.
Well, I don't know. But I will say, hey, Nintendo, put out demos before the game comes out, and you could get people excited about it.
Who would have thought?
It depends on the game, and it depends on the demo. I mean, you just talked about the Brain Age demo, which that game's not out yet either, but it's a very good demo.
Monster Hunter Tri, not so much that demo.
Let's not talk about the stupid disc demo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, demos can go both ways, and sometimes games have bad demos, and the game itself – I mean, Ni No Kuni had a bad demo on PS3 just a couple months ago. They just kind of threw you into things without explaining what the heck was going on. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of take things with a grain of salt, but a demo can totally make or break a game's sort of hype level, you know, before it comes out.
And I will say, I'm excited that the day one DLC, which I believe is free.
Yes, the first one's free. Tell your friends.
Which, by the way, every game that has day one DLC, it should always be free.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
it's a great idea. Yeah, it's a great idea.
Because otherwise, it should have been on the fucking disc.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually like the idea that they're going to have DLC, which is probably why I'll buy this game on the 3DS, even though I'm going to instantly regret it because it's going to take up a fuck ton of memory. Like the only complaint I had about the game was that they put voice acting in, but they don't actually voice act the lines of dialogue. I'm hoping maybe that's just a feature of the demo and they up their game a little bit. Because a lot of times people go, huh? What? Yes. Yeah. While they're saying completely unrelated crap is going to be kind of distracting.
Yeah.
But
I think that is in the full game too, because Scott complained about that a little bit.
It's so dumb. It's so dumb. You bothered to have them voice act.
All right. Well, we're going to be hearing lots more about Fire Emblem in the coming weeks, it sounds like. But we're going to wrap up new business right now. And when we come back, we've got your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Alright, first up we have a review of Ika-chan for 3DS by Guillaume. It's a game, you're a squid, this is the review. He just talked about it, so you know what you're getting into.
But read it anyway.
That's right.
Of course.
We also have a review of Puddle for Wii U by Patrick Barnett. It's a downloadable game where you get to control some liquids. Now, this isn't Fluidity, this is Puddle. Patrick praises the gameplay variety, by which I mean he praises the devs for letting you play as decayed rat goo.
This is a real thing?
This is a thing that he mentions in the review. I have not played it, but apparently, yes, you get to play as decayed rat goo.
It's a delicacy in Sweden.
Probably. Fucking Swedes.
Great on poutine.
We have a review mini, Kirby's Star Stacker on the 3DS Virtual Console by Zach Kaplan. Oh, it's a Kirby game with object stacking. Okay, at least it's about enclosing blocks rather than lining up blocks. We have a review, Scribble Nuts Unlimited for 3DS by Tyler Olu. Did you forget that this game was also on 3DS? I did. Turns out it has the same evolution to the Scribble Nuts formula as this puzzle-solving open-world Wii U Big Brother. No Nintendo characters, though.
No Nintendo characters. That's a Wii U exclusive feature that makes it worth the extra $20.
Yes.
We also have a review of Fire Emblem Awakening for 3DS by Scott Thompson. So, I don't have anything funny to say here. It turns out this is a really good game, so go read it and then buy it. Go. Buy. Buy it. Buy it.
Today!
We also have a review of The Cave for Wii U by Guillaume. Surprisingly, it's not about shadow puppetry or allegories about humanity's quest for knowledge. It's actually a quest for puzzles, I guess.
Alright, and finally we have impressions for Balloon Fight on Wii U Virtual Console. What would a Nintendo console be without its own version of Balloon Fight? Answer, in no way, shape, or form harm. Regardless, we get our first view of Virtual Console running natively on Wii U, and that is worth the 30 cents. Balloon Fight? Well, Awada may not like the answer. So be sure to check out all of this original content and much more over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Konnichiwa, watashi wa Jonathan desu.
Awesome.
No. That was okay, right?
That's fine.
Okay, good. That makes me feel better. Welcome back to the show, everyone. It's time for listener mail. For the first time in a few weeks, actually, we're catching up on some listener mail. Probably not as much as we would like since the first segment ran longer than expected, but we're going to get to some of it, and we'll probably come back and do more of it next week, too. So don't worry if you don't hear your email. There's a good chance that we will get to it. And as always, the address to send your emails is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And there's always a link to that in the show notes on the website as well. So we try to make it easy for you to find. And Guillaume is going to have the first email this week.
Chris writes, I was surprised to hear some of your impressions of Nintendo Direct, specifically that the mentions of a 3D Mario and Mario Kart didn't excite you because you already knew about them. While yes, it's a fairly safe assumption that there's going to be a new 3D Mario and Mario Kart for Wii U, I learned long ago that nothing is a foregone conclusion when it comes to Nintendo. Of course, it makes sense to keep making these games, but this is Nintendo we're talking about, and I guess I'm surprised to hear that you guys just assume that they will do what makes sense and what makes them money. Remember when there were no Mario platformers between Mario World and Mario 64? Remember how long it took to get a new Metroid after Super Metroid? Remember when they decided cartridges were the way to go for N64? I was totally impressed with the Nintendo Direct because I didn't assume Virtual Console was coming, and I didn't assume that a new 3D Mario was coming. I thought the humble nature of coming out and asking us to be patient and apologizing for the lack of software went a long way, and I'm more excited about E3 than I was before. Also, I'll gladly take Balloon Fight for 30 cents.
You know, I think it's very telling that the three examples Chris provided about, you know, when Nintendo did things that weren't expected or they didn't do what you did expect them were all a long time ago. You know, mm-hmm. The lack of a Metroid 64 and cartridges and, you know, there being a really long time between, especially with 2D Mario, between Mario World and New Super Mario Brothers, 15 years later. I guess I'm just, I just think they've moved into a new era, and I think the days of not assuming Nintendo will do the thing that will make them a lot of money are long gone, because the company's in a financial situation where they have to keep releasing Mario games because those games sell so much. So the really surprising, creative, innovative stuff is going to happen more on the periphery.
You know, yeah,
those are the more minor titles or the really bizarre ones. And I think they have to be fairly conservative with most of their main franchises because that's what's keeping them afloat.
I mean, they've also really figured out over time what makes the most money. And also they have this strange practice of really not creating a heck of a lot of new IPs in terms of platformers and stuff like that, you know? Their new IPs are typically, they try to make new genres with their new IPs now, rather than innovate in existing genres.
Well, that's funny because it is true. They really haven't created many new, they've created a couple new IPs, especially with like the Wii blank line, but they certainly haven't created a ton of new characters over the past decade or so. And I think that's a very common complaint about Nintendo, but I also think they've gotten away with it in large part, especially in the West, because they've brought over and localized a lot more games that they wouldn't have in previous generations. So they bring over stuff like Fire Emblem for the first time back in the early 2000s. That series has been around since Famicom in the 80s in Japan, but we've never had it before, so it's new to us. And I think at this point, they've kind of run out of those. I mean, those games are obviously still coming out, but they've run out of surprises and they've run out of things that were only released in Japan that we've never been exposed to before. And I think now the onus really is, especially for the Western audience, they really do need to create something new that we haven't seen before.
And you can see that though. Like they made a Kid Icarus game, for God's sake. I mean, short of reviving some of those one-off games that came out, you know, in the
Demon World and
Punch-Out.
Detective Club, or
what's the ninja game
the Kamaru Ninja Castle?
Yeah, I mean, like they could do stuff like that, but ultimately, there's no real brand cachet to any of those. You might as well just go ahead and make new games, new plot lines. I mean, really, seeing as every part of that Nintendo Direct announcements, with the exception of the X trailer at the end, was predicted by at least one of us during our prediction show.
And you know, I think the Yoshi game would have been pretty shocking to the world if it hadn't been leaked so many times over such a long period. And it had just been it, and it seemed like a very natural progression for that studio and you know, and what they do. But certainly it was a brand new game. We've never seen it before. And it's very exciting, you know, so I'm not complaining about that.
Or it's epic garbage, depending on who you ask.
Well, in terms of, you know, in terms of Mario and Mario Kart, I mean, look, these are the games that are Nintendo's bread and butter. They are going to make another Mario Kart.
Yeah.
That's a fact. They are not going back on that series.
And those two games are following the same timeline on the Wii U relative to what they followed on the 3DS. I mean, effectively. So, yeah, I mean, it's not shocking these games are coming out. No, I mean, I'm glad to hear.
Yeah, I'm happy about it, but I can't get excited or say anything substantive about it because they haven't actually shown them yet. They haven't said dick about them. They just, the fact that they exist is, you know, if they told me there was a new if they told me Mother 4 was coming out, okay, they don't have to show me Mother 4. If they say that Mother 4 exists, which it doesn't, by the way, and it probably never will. But that is earth-shattering news, okay? The fact that there's a new 3D Mario game, I know. I know there is. Now, once they show it and they show what it actually does and what it looks like and what are the new gameplay mechanics, and that is when I will get super excited. But I have to deal in, you know, these are just a certain tolerance that you build up over doing this for so many years.
Yeah, it's like, oh my God, there's going to be a Halo 5? Oh my God, what a surprise.
Wait,
like,
they announced that?
It's not surprising. They don't. That's the point. They don't have to.
The examples that were given, I think that, you know, there was no new Metroid after Super Metroid.
Yeah.
Well, Super Metroid didn't light the charts on fire even back then. I think from the way that Nintendo talks about it. And then you know, we heard Miyamoto saying
that's a cult classic.
We heard Miyamoto saying that we wanted to come up with something on the N64, but we didn't have any ideas of how to bring it to that platform. But does it look like they need that excuse to bring a 2D Mario game to a platform? they really don't, because the sales justify it. Like they don't need to find a way to make it special. Like they're perfectly fine just, you know, making a new one that's more of the same, and that's fine. That's what people want. And
I mean, yeah, it's like any of these companies, if they strike gold, they're going to keep hitting that gold vein until it runs dry. Capcom, Resident Evil.
Yeah, Capcom's a great example. How many Monster Hunter games has Capcom made since the first one? Like 70.
Well, or there are just three, right, so far?
No.
Because they're going to come out with a fourth one soon.
There are more than three versions of Monster Hunter 3.
Yes. Yeah, it's true.
Yes, this is very true.
But yeah, like when you look at the charts of, sometimes you see those of how many copies Mario sold, the 2D ones, and like you see a huge, you know, sprite of the DS New Super Mario next to the sales of every other Mario before it, and it just dwarfs them. I think that's a point at which like the writing was on the wall. Like when the DS game sold as well as it
did
in Japan.
New Super Mario Brothers on DS has sold more than every 3D Mario game combined. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that's true. Or it's very close to true.
Well, it sold better than Mario 3 on the NES.
And hey, that sucks because I like 3D Mario better than 2D Mario, especially the new Super Mario Brothers series. Mm-hmm. But they got to keep making the stuff that sells. Now, they can make other stuff, and they can take their chances elsewhere, and they will. But, you know, Nintendo has become an increasingly conservative, and I have to admit, an increasingly predictable company. I mean, I predicted that the Wii U would have a controller with its own touchscreen, 3 months before that came out, back in E3 2011. So, I just, you know, unfortunately... I think it's because the margins, you know, the profit margins are becoming smaller. The gaming industry is more competitive and it's a little more homogenized in some ways. And, you know, Nintendo will always surprise us in some ways or another, but to depict Nintendo as this crazy, just mercurial, totally unpredictable, wild, unreliable producer of video games, I just don't think that's accurate. It might have been at one time, but I don't think that's true anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It was when they were still kind of dipping their toe into you know, different parts of the, especially the U.S. market. I mean, they were just testing out the market to see what works all the way through into probably the 90s, mid-90s, late 90s even.
Yeah.
All the way into the N64 era.
In a way, like the companies are becoming more predictable because the gamers are like the people buying the games are becoming more predictable.
Yeah, well, games are the gaming market is bigger, and therefore you get to see what more people are buying. So it's, you know, you can see where the herd goes much easier now than you could back in 1995.
Yeah, and it's really weird. I don't think we've ever seen this trend before of people just buying series annually. But it seems like the biggest ones now, they almost have to do that to keep retaining their mind share. You know, like who would have thought that Assassin's Creed would have been a series that you would annualize?
I did.
But Ubisoft did exactly that.
Yeah, I don't think it was a good idea, but they have done it.
Not necessarily, but I think that they've sold plenty of copies of Brotherhood and the other one.
Which is, it's just shocking because of the scope of those games and how many people it takes to make them. It's crazy. I mean, Call of Duty is the same way. It's a mind-boggling, you know, production to put on every single year.
Yeah.
But they do it because if they don't, they're leaving $1 billion on the table.
Yeah.
I mean, they've shown demonstrably that they can sell that game every year. And so if they don't, these are publicly held companies, and so is Nintendo. So if Nintendo doesn't make a Mario Kart for their new system, they're going to have an investor revolt.
Right.
Because that's $1 billion that they could have made. So they have to do it. We just have to hope that they do it in a way that's interesting and refreshing and is super fun to play, right? Because we're going to buy it, they're going to make it, and we're going to buy it regardless.
Yep. And to Nintendo's credit, like they could, I guess, annualize certain of their series, and because we've been hit by so many Mario games last year, like it looks like they have, like they've even gone beyond that. But probably, like we're not going to see another 2D Mario in the 3DS. Perhaps we're not going to see another 2D one on the Wii U. We can say that, yeah, all the Mario games play the same and kind of look the same, but it's the same thing for Call of Duty, the same thing for these other series. And Nintendo, despite Well, I guess one of the reasons why they don't annualize them or they don't have that need is because they don't have as many losses to recoup on those late games. Like, there's not, the games don't have as much of a big budget as those other series. And so Nintendo doesn't have to keep pumping them out to recoup the losses or the investment that they've made on the previous one.
Yeah. Yeah, but they also have a smaller target audience because their games are not multi-platform. So
yeah, true.
It's all relative, but I do think in general Nintendo's big releases probably are more profitable than a lot of the third-party ones. You know, if nothing else, they don't have to pay a license fee to Sony or Microsoft or, you know. So so they do make more money than third parties do on their games. So that's part of it. Anyway, yeah, as far as Virtual Console, I mean, we knew that was coming because Nintendo said that was coming last year.
Right.
So we didn't know when it was coming, and we didn't know exactly, you know, what form it would take. I think the surprising part was the reduced price for people who already own it on Wii and stuff like that. But it was not a shock that Virtual Console came to Wii U. They had promised it.
I didn't have a chance to react on that. I can't say that. I don't know, like, it's really, I'm more of the point of view that if you choose to upgrade, it's not really a reduced price, it's really you're paying extra on top of what you've already paid, so I can't say I was too enthused by that news. I kind of expected the upgrade to be free, although I, you know, like, I'm not shocked or I'm not angry that it isn't, I'm just going to choose not to upgrade most of my games.
Yeah, I kind of felt the same way. Yeah. It's like, I can see why, logically, why they're charging for it, but at the same time, I'm like, come on, throw us a bone here.
I'm not even asking for a handout. I still maintain it actually would have been good business sense for them to do it for free for people who already bought it, because that builds up word of free, it's almost essentially free word of mouth for everybody else who hasn't already bought it and is going to have to pay full price anyway.
A flat fee, like you suggested, like $10, and all of your games are upgraded, that would have convinced me to pay $10. But I don't think I'm going to invest that. But what mainly pisses me off about the news, kind of, is that I can't be really enthused about all these VC games being upgraded to the Wii U, just as I can't be enthused by the NES games that we're getting on the eShop on 3DS. Like, it's just... they're just reserving us things that we've bought maybe like 3 years ago. And like this lack of new retro releases is not at all what I was looking for.
Yeah, if I want to play Kirby's Adventure on my Wii U, I already can. In fact, there's like three different ways that I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not super inclined to pay $1 to upgrade. Now, I might pay the 30 cents because that's one of the specials. But it's very, very few games I'm going to be convinced to do the upgrade, because I just don't think it's I think what you get is not really that worth it.
I mean, what else extra can you do with it besides playing on the gamepad?
You get, like, they add a Miiverse to it.
They added
which Miiverse. Means you can take screenshots.
They added save states. They added.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's a much better. I mean, have you done the balloon fight yet?
No.
I didn't bother because I don't like balloon fight.
So I downloaded it just to see what it was like, and also because it was 30 cents.
Yeah, I'm waiting for F-Zero to do that.
It is a much cleaner experience, and I can see why Nintendo feels justified in charging $1 for it.
But see, at the same time, though, I've heard that if you do upgrade, if you have a saved game, it blows away your saved game.
I don't know about that. I don't know.
How would you know? Because Balloon Fight doesn't have saves.
Yeah, I think that Kotaku asked Nintendo or something.
Yeah.
I would wait to see that be reality. Because, and first off, if Kotaku is the source, instantly it's -5.
Yeah, if that's the case, then I'm like, come on, Nintendo.
That's just bizarre.
If you just ask Nintendo people upright, you're almost certainly going to get the wrong answer. I think we've all seen this in our careers working on Nintendo News, that just asking a Nintendo rep outright does not tend to get you the correct answer.
Yeah, especially Nintendo of America. They're just not that informed. You know, I just think they just
You know,
don't.
It's at the same time, though, it's like, okay, well, oh, of course, that wouldn't make any sense. You should be able to port over your saved game. But at the same time, the way that Nintendo does these games, they're effectively, like, you know, they're games unto themselves. Like, it's not like it's some platform they're building on. Like, each of these games is like a self-contained unit. Yeah. So it's like, I could completely see them not being able to port a saved game from the old software to the new software. Like, emulator wise, like that, like I could actually see that being a reality. Unfortunately, who knows? Hopefully not.
I think they should probably make their new emulator compatible with the save file of the old emulator.
I would absolutely
agree. That seems very fixable.
Yes. Yes.
I'm not an expert on emulator development, but I feel like there's a way to do that.
I would totally agree. Yep. That's why I refuse to believe it, but at the same time,
you totally believe it.
You know, I could see it happening.
You could be talked into believing it.
Yes. Now, the other thing that Chris talks about here, actually, wanted to touch on is the lack of software that Iwata apologized for.
Oh, that was interesting. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I feel like that's very, you could see that coming a mile away. It's very predictable, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that he apologized for it, but then in the same breath, he says, unfortunately, we can't do anything about it. I mean, their replacement for new Wii U games in January and February is Balloon Fight. That is literally what they're offering up as a stopgap.
Well, two things to be fair on that. One, Iwata thinks Balloon Fight is amazing.
Yeah, well, he's wrong.
Oh,
yeah. He's a little bit
the music
biased.
Is great, but it's not a good game. I know that's his baby, but it's not good.
And two, them apologizing for things isn't really all that surprising, because this is the same company who apologized because there weren't enough copies of Animal Crossing 3DS available in Japan, despite the fact you can download it digitally.
They have become a bit sniveling over the past year.
They issued a public apology that there was not enough retail copies available of a digital game.
Somebody's going to cry in the next Nintendo Direct. Iwata's just going to break down.
He's just going to sit there and have a public cry. Oh,
yeah, he's just going to like break up with his wife or something right there on Nintendo Direct.
I don't want to break him down, because it was one of the best Nintendo Directs they've ever done. they did talk about a lot of games I'm very excited about. They didn't necessarily show them, but they talked about them. And ultimately, I'm not disappointed really with anything that they revealed.
I mean, ultimately, I would think everybody here would agree that it was the X trailer that brought the house down.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. It would have been quite underwhelming if not for that. But they did show that, and
they showed video of that, and it looks awesome.
You know, look, it's fucking
amazing.
Rad,
yeah.
So
they
there you go.
Yep.
It was kind of like a. When they have an E3 presentation and they don't have much to show and they know it, and they have like a game that's really cool, but by and large they know they've got a bunch of B-level titles that they've this year, and they just sort of stacked the deck for themselves and then just sort of did their drop the mic at the end. I mean, it followed the same formula they've used in the past.
Yeah. And well, I mean, the exciting thing was they showed it in Europe and in North America, as well as in Japan, which you can't say for the next game we're going to talk about. Let's just segue right into the next email, which John is going to read.
John is going to read. All right.
Chris from Milwaukee writes, I'm curious what you think about Earthbound's chances of re-releasing in the West given the recent announcement of Wii U Virtual Console. I realize that even bringing up the prospect after 6 years of waiting is beating a dead horse, but I feel that there might finally be a glimmer of hope. After all, Mother 2 was never released for the Wii Virtual Console in Japan either, but it's finally seeing a VC release there as part of the Virtual Console trial campaign. Fans complained that it wasn't a part of the campaign here, but I'm sure that if it is released here, NOA would want their full $8 from every member of the Rabbit fanbase. After Itoi's recent vague comments about retooling Mother for a re-release, is there a chance that whatever was done to the game also made it ready for release in the West? Bonus question. With GBA coming to VC and on Wii U, will we finally see Mother 3 released in the West?
I'm saying there's a chance.
I'm saying there is
for...
So you're saying there's a chance.
For Mother 2... For Mother 2, there's a chance. For Mother 3, no.
There's a lot of people that share the opinion that Earthbound is probably coming because of this. Like, Jeremy Parrish, I think, wrote on 1UP about like the increased chances and exactly the same kind of...
Oh, that's clickbait. That is such hard clickbait. It is! Why the fuck would you write about Earthbound if you're not trying to get clickbait? Nobody gives a shit about that series!
I have to think. The thing is, though, right? Like, Earthbound, when it was released, that was actually a very big game when it was released. Like, it was actually promoted.
It
know?
Was, but like,
It wasn't just a throwaway title. I mean, you know, maybe, regardless of how it performed over here, it was actually a big title for Nintendo at the time.
It is
so, very surprised they haven't
released it. It is a niche game that an even nicher number of people care about. Ultimately.
Yeah, but I
are
mean,
you not a fan, James?
No, I like the game, but I think it's massively overrated. I think
the reason that people talk about it so much, maybe this is maybe I'm wrong about this, but my feeling is that because of the setting of the game and the great writing and the weird sense of humor, and it you know, I just heard on the A4 Play podcast, John Riccardi was saying that his mother got totally addicted to Earthbound. And I'm not really surprised to hear that. I think that the people who love Earthbound feel that if Nintendo had given it another chance or had supported it maybe in just a different way than they did originally, that it could appeal to a much broader audience.
And those people
and maybe that's why they're advocating wrong. For it so hard. And I don't necessarily disagree. I don't think Virtual Console is the, you know, the vector through which they're going to spread Earthbound mania to
hey, niche sales approach.
Like, do you think that perhaps, you know, from another angle, Operation Rainfall and the success of that, and, you know, perhaps made Nintendo think, well, if basically the same kind of people who asked for this game to be brought over bought this many copies at retail of Xenoblade or ordered it through our website, even though, you know, like it was really inconvenient, perhaps like these same people will actually buy the game if we put it on the VC.
No, because less people care about this game than cared about Xenoblade.
I don't know. They've been vocal for so long.
No,
like,
No. I'm right about this. There is no chance I'm wrong about this. Absolutely no chance. Because Xenoblade had massive, massive coverage once it realized it was coming out in Europe. Go find me a website that's writing a lot about Earthbound right now. Go find it. Go.
Well, they would if it was coming out.
But it wasn't coming. But Xenoblade wasn't coming out here. That's why they were writing about it.
I don't know. A couple of years ago, back when there was still a chance that the game would come on the VC, and right around the time that people realized, like, oh crap, it looks like Nintendo is not planning on bringing it. I remember a lot of editorials.
Starman clickbait.
I think if Earthbound was released only on the European Virtual Console, there'd be a shitstorm, just like there was about Xenoblade.
Yeah.
And it would have a different flavor because it is not a brand new game. It's a game that has been released in America in the past. But look, ultimately, we don't know yet because the game isn't out in Japan on Virtual Console yet. And I think that's the moment of truth. Because the reason this hasn't been done already is there's some copyright problems with the music. So the question is, are they really going to change the music in the Japanese version? Because if they do, that makes it much easier for them to then take that and just apply the old localization patch and then release that in Europe and America. The issue is Japan has very lax copyright laws.
Oh, yeah.
And it may be that they just never bothered to release Earthbound on the Wii Virtual Console in Japan. Cause why not? I mean, they did put a demo of it in.
Well,
Brawl.
They have like 800 games on there.
Well, I think that proves the point more. They have 800 games on there and they couldn't find the time to do Earthbound? They have.
Well, yeah. So there's something more fishy, I think, than just like laziness or, oh, we don't think the sales really warrant it. Like, I guarantee you that a lot of these 800 titles sold less than Earthbound would have. Like, Mother 2 would have.
That's fair, but there are also actual licensing problems with Earthbound because of Shigesato Itoi. He has certain rights over that game, and I don't think Nintendo can just re-release it or do whatever they want with it without his help. The other thing is, around the time that they would have released Earthbound on Virtual Console in Japan, they were just releasing the Mother Collection for Game Boy Advance, which had Mother 1 and 2 on it, so they might have avoided a Virtual Console release because they didn't want to cannibalize the GBA cartridge, which is very possible. So
yeah, that's fair.
What I'm saying is I think there is a chance that they're going to say, well, in Japan, the copyright laws are so pathetic that we can release the original version of this without changing a damn thing. And we'll have to see, because if they do that, then it's not coming to America, okay? But if they decide to go ahead and, just to be safe, fix the music and change it so that it no longer rips off Beatles songs, and it makes it really just airtight, this is totally legal for us to re-release in Japan because we've changed the music, then there's an excellent chance that it might come out in the West. But I think it could go either way because they're doing Japan first. So I don't think we'll really know until then. But as far as Mother 3, man, no way. Because there is no official translation for Mother 3. They'd have to do that from scratch. Yeah. And that's not happening.
Yeah, and that's, like I said, it's so niche that it would just wouldn't be worth it. Although otherwise, they would have done it on the GBA. Because it's not like the GBA wasn't want for games at that point. They could have put out that game and it done reasonably well, but they decided that the market wasn't there.
Well, okay, bear with me here.
No.
What if they got XSEED to release Mother 3 and
sure,
to do something they've already done, do something they've already done, which is just buy the fan translation.
They didn't buy the...
Have they done
no.
that?
No. Well, have they?
They've done that for no, they've done that for in other games.
I don't know that Nintendo would let them buy the fan translation. Because remember, Nintendo ultimately edited the translation of the games that XSEED published on their behalf. They were just edited by a different branch of the company. I think Nintendo might be more than a little skittish about letting them just use a fan translation.
I think it's a shame that Nintendo of Europe wasn't, back when Mother 3 first came out, back in, 2005? I think it's a shame that Nintendo of Europe wasn't what it is today. Because if it was, Nintendo Europe might have translated it into English just for their own regions. And then there might be some kind of way for a company like XSEED or even Nintendo of America to go back and use that translation to now release Mother 3 in whatever form they want in North America. But because that didn't happen and there is no official English translation of Mother 3, period, there's not. I just don't think Nintendo's gonna bother with it. I don't think they're gonna go out and pay for fan translation because that sets a really funky precedent. It kind of condones, hacking and emulation and stuff like that. So I don't think they're gonna go into those waters, and I don't think they're gonna just go out and tell some third party publisher. I also feel like even a company like XSEED might really have to think long and hard about whether it would be profitable to localize and publish a game like Mother 3.
A Game Boy Advance game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You really have to question the business sense in that.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you're going to charge $100 for it.
Yeah.
If you're going to say, look, there's such a small audience for this that we're going to have to charge a really premium price in order to make it just viable and go out there and charge like $100 even for like a digital only copy of it.
For a digital copy?
That is such a bad press. They're going to get such awful press coverage of something like that. That's not a good idea either.
I'm just going to bring up 2 points. The Oath and Fergana used as a base of fan translation. So XSEED has done that in the past.
Yeah,
that's really cool. That's really cool.
The GBA games are coming to the Wii U Virtual Console. And XSEED doesn't have any qualms about releasing download-only software for $30.
Download-only GBA software.
Well, why not?
Because it's GBA software. And because Mother 3 is not worth $30.
I think more people would buy Mother 3 at $30 on the VC Wii U than there are people who bought Unchained Blades.
That's because Unchained Blades isn't good.
Checkmate.
That's not a checkmate.
Sir. I can't argue with that. I mean, you might be right about that. But ultimately, I think the best chance of Mother 1 or 3 ever coming out in North America is a remake. And
yeah,
whether
probably.
Nintendo does that or maybe they license that out to a company like Atlas or XSEED and let them do it. But I think that's the only chance because you have to sell it as a new game or a new version of the game in order to get enough interest to potentially make the money back that it's going to cost to localize it. And I think there is a chance one day of something like a Mother Trilogy or Mother All-Stars, remake collection that Nintendo does. I could see that happening one day, but I don't think they're going to do it game by game, and I don't think it's happening anytime soon.
We'll see.
That's my opinion. All right, let's get one more email in for this episode. This one comes from our friend Jay Ceezy in Japan. You heard him on the last Famicast, and that's James Charlton, of course. He says, I too thought Pandora's Tower was never going to go stateside, which prevented me from sending the original version of this email, slagging off NOA. A few exciting things have happened this past week or so, which has made me completely reevaluate them. Maybe. Number one, they're releasing Pandora's Tower. XSEED is. Number two, Fist of the North Star is getting an eShop release. More on that later. Number three, Project X Zone is also coming.
That's fucking confusing.
Yeah. Points number two and three are especially exciting to me as this relates to the Project Rainfall situation. What I mean is, crazy-ass Japanese games are coming to the West in super quick time, mainly because they're not changing the voiceovers, which to me is a fantastic idea. Imagine if The Last Story came out just 2 months after its Japan release in that way. We'd have got it March 27th, 2011. 2011. Pandora's Tower, May 26th, 2011. Xenoblade, that could have come out August 10th, 2010. Yeah. Holy shit. So my question is, would you have preferred to see the Rainfall games have got the Fist of the North Star treatment, as in throwing Japan retail games onto the eShop quickly with just subtitles for a reduced price? Or do you think that there isn't a big enough audience to ever sell games that way on a Nintendo system? Of course, the infrastructure didn't exist on Wii, but imagine if another three amazing games came out on Wii U in Japan with no promise of a Western release. Who are we kidding? This is guaranteed to happen.
So is the choice here we don't get the game, or is the choice that we get the game years later? Because if it's get the game years later, I'd much rather do what they did, even though it was complete bullshittery. Because ultimately we ended up with a really well-localized product versus just...
Yeah, I think having the voice acting actually localized and done really well in English is worth waiting even, 6 months or even a year. I think the amount of time that we actually waited for Xenoblade is fucking ludicrous.
Right.
But the amount of time Europe had to wait for it is fine.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think the only reason we waited so long on these games was probably more due to NOA being stubborn than it was for any logistical reason.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Fist of the North Star is sort of a weird exception because it's fucking Fist of the North Star. If you don't know what that is, it's about a nuclear holocaust where some dude gets so ripped, when he punches you, you explode into blood.
Yeah, or you split in half. You have that option.
That's true.
It's ultra stupid.
Yeah, it's pretty retarded.
It's one of the dumbest anime series ever created. But
and you're dumb if you like it. Eh? Am I right? Am I right? Yeah.
I was going to say
JCZ.
I don't know that I can sign off on that.
I was
going to
say it's dumb in the same way that the Fast and Furious.
Like pro wrestling is dumb.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
It's over the top. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean,
and it knows it's ridiculous.
I mean, one of the quotes from the series is basically after he's punched the dude, turning going, "You're already dead," and then he blows up into a cloud of blood.
Or also,
a
direct
quote.
Much.
It's amazing and stupid at the same time.
It is.
And wonderful.
I will say, I say that I make fun of it. I actually have some of the comics at home.
Oh, nice.
I do.
Of course you do.
I thought the other guy split you in half when he kicked you. I thought it was one guy splits you in half when you get kicked and the other one blows you up when you get punched.
But
going back
years.
To the idea of selling games, without the localization, the Yakuza series did that for starting with a second one. Although, you could kind of justify it by saying, well, it kind of adds to the authenticity anyway. The game takes place in Japan. So,
all these Yakuza speak perfect English. I don't understand at all what's going on.
And like the first time they did that was with the second game, and it was on the PlayStation 2. So, the install base was so huge, I guess, that Sega could justify it. Like, they could think, well, I'm sure enough people will end up buying this. I don't know if... What's the next one that they published? 3 on the PlayStation 3? I don't know if that hit their target, but, the situation...
Well, but they're releasing the fourth one, aren't they? I mean,
they are?
They've continued on, although at this point, I'm not sure that any game Sega releases actually makes a profit. I can't tell. Their marketing and just the things that they choose to release are so strange that I don't even know anymore.
Fist of the North Star is also being simultaneously, or almost, released digitally also on PSN. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I guess that whoever publishes this is also, edging their bets a little bit.
Like, that's smart because you get, you know, cross promotion. So regardless of which version you buy, they get the same. They can have a more concerted PR and marketing effort for that. So it's smart. I think it's great. Fist of North Star would not do well at retail.
No,
but the fact that they can release it on the eShop with, you know, much lower fixed costs and make a higher profit means that they, you know, they can get away with selling fewer copies. And the fact that they're just only, you know, localizing the text and they're leaving in the Japanese voices and just subtitling the whole thing, I think that's fine. You know, I like foreign movies and I don't watch them dubbed. Except Studio Ghibli stuff because, you know, because Disney does an excellent job with the dubbing on those.
I think in case of Fist of the North Star, that's probably also the most authentic way you could present it to fans of that series. Because odds are they probably watched subbed anime of it.
Yeah, yeah. And they probably own manga and read it backwards. You know, like they read it right
because
to left.
I don't recall any companies licensing and dubbing Fist of the North Star into English.
What do we make of Project X Zone, though?
That's cool.
Everything I've said up to this point, throw it out the window because this makes no fucking sense to me whatsoever.
I mean, from a licensing standpoint, this game seems like a nightmare. Because it makes sense in Japan, but it's the same reason the Shonen Jump games couldn't come to the U.S. It's a licensing pain in the ass. But I guess so many of these are owned by the same company, it makes it a lot easier. Because it is a crossover game, and so many of them are owned by such a small number of players. That anything else?
It's a crossover game with Capcom, Sega, and Namco.
Yeah,
I mean, yes, those companies all exist in America, so it's conceivable that you could get the license set up. But
maybe Capcom just threw their hands in the air and they thought, well, if we can bring Tatsunoko versus Capcom to the Wii, you know, why not?
So this is the conversation that happened. Sega called Capcom and said, "Dude, we need the money." And Namco's like, I don't care,
help
whatever.
A brother out.
And then Capcom goes, wait, is Mega Man in this game? No? Okay, we're good. You can release it. That's how it went down.
Is Mega Man not in
it? I think Mega Man characters are. I don't remember.
Surely he is.
He's been blacklisted. Mega Man pissed somebody off, and now he's on the blacklist.
If Mega Man is in the game, he is not.
He named names at the commission.
He so did.
Regardless, you know, this game looks kind of cool. So I'm happy with it.
I think Danny and I want to say Ty Sugar have both played it. They've talked about it on the Famicast a little bit. They seem to enjoy it. This does seem like the kind of, because it's a strategy RPG, it's very complicated.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, I would imagine there's a lot of story, a lot of writing. This just seems expensive to localize, even aside from the licensing, which is clearly going to, you know, incur some kind of cost. But the amount of effort, the amount of text that must be in this game just seems like this is the last game I would ever expect to come out of Japan. This is so crazy.
You know, if the three parties originally had, when they settled it, well, four technically, because they're the developer is none of the above. If they had all just sort of settled in at the beginning and said, all right, guys, we're planning on releasing this outside Japan too, so let's get everything together from the very beginning.
Hmm.
It may not have been that tremendous. They probably could have saved a lot during the development process.
Okay. If they just did worldwide deals
right in
the first place, yeah.
Yeah.
A couple of things transpired from the, I think it was an investors meeting that Nintendo had last night. And I think that Iwata said that since, you know, they're struggling so much to have Western companies develop for the 3DS, which is not doing as well in the Western world as it is in Japan.
Because of Monster Hunter and Animal Crossing.
Yeah, they would help finance localization of 3DS games from Japan to Western audiences.
And potentially publish them too.
Right.
Yeah, I think he actually mentioned publishing. So this one, Project X Zone, is not being published by Nintendo, but what if, you know, somehow Nintendo was also kind of...
They kicked in some money or they waived some of their normal fees or something.
Well, then I really kind of question their sanity because this game seems like a hard sell
If all they did was say they waived some of the publishing fees, then really it's no skin off their back.
Okay, fair enough.
Because
it's good PR for them. It kind of builds up a library. It gets more people talking about 3DS games.
And if the game really is good, then maybe it gets good reviews and gets, you know, some decent sales numbers. I mean, there are recognizable characters in the game that you could market.
Sure.
I mean, you could certainly build an ad campaign around it to interest fans of these games, and maybe it's enough to sell, you know, a handful of 3DS units.
Yeah, certainly not a bad thing. I'm just kind of shocked. I mean, I would imagine that the stuff Nintendo's talking about in terms of, you know, helping to localize, it's probably probably falls into more of like the, you know, Layton versus Phoenix Wright and Dragon Quest VII Remake, and probably more of the larger releases like that, you know, that are just kind of borderline in terms of coming to the West. But who knows?
Yeah, but it would also be smart to help the more niche releases to, you know, take off.
There is an argument to be made there, and there could just be, like I said, Nintendo could easily make the burden or the barrier lower by just saying, all right, we're going to waive a lot of where we get our skin off the pie, and maybe you guys can, we'll localize it then, knowing that if you release it in Western markets, you're going to get a higher profit margin than you would otherwise. I mean, there are things they can do where it doesn't cost them anything. They don't make as much money, but if the game never got localized, they wouldn't have made the money anyway.
Yeah. I'm just glad to see them acknowledging this problem because it's serious. We've talked about it a lot. If you think about, like, probably the only notable Western-developed 3DS game coming out in at least the next 6 months on 3DS is that Castlevania game, which is being developed in Europe, but it's published, still published by a Japanese company.
Yeah.
So, and I would say even, you know, even companies like Konami and Capcom aren't really supporting 3DS all that much, and especially in the West. But
Capcom's busy making Mega Man games we'll never release.
but outside, I mean, Capcom is catching up a little bit with Monster Hunter, but you know, in terms of like actual Western publishers like Ubisoft and EA and Activision, they're not doing shit on 3DS.
No, I mean, Disney has done a bit. Warner Brothers has done a bit. But, I mean, they're relatively minor players.
Yeah. Really crazy, man.
Yeah, the question earlier about, you know, how come we're not excited because of the Nintendo Direct, I think that this kind of bit of news that came out yesterday about more localizations is what really gets me excited about going to E3. I want to see a ton of 3DSs everywhere in every booth.
Yes, I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree. But I will say there is a bright shining spot for Western developed games on 3DS, and it's through the eShop. It's the independent stuff, you know. It's the Renegade Kid and the Gunman Clive and that kind of stuff. I'm very excited about. And that stuff seems to be doing well, you know, even like the Zen Pinball stuff seems to be doing really well. So there's a lot more activity there, but in the retail space, dude, it's dire. I mean, Western publishers don't give a fuck about 3DS.
Yeah, they really don't.
And I don't understand that because it's selling really, I mean, you said it's not selling as well as it is in Japan. It's still doing really well. Really well.
It's because, I mean, a lot of them have shut down teams, so they're focusing on the annualized games that we talked about. I mean,
and a lot of them are spending a lot more effort these days on smartphone stuff, and maybe they no longer have the infrastructure to make a 3DS retail game that's actually, you know, justifies the significant price point.
Right.
3DS
well,
game.
That's
maybe,
the thing
maybe
too.
That's
I mean,
what it comes
you have
down
to think
to.
Right with smartphones. I mean, I have to like with you know, 3DS, you have to go through the hassle of getting a dev kit, going through all that kind of stuff, right? I mean, with smartphones, I mean, you know, really, like, how cheap is it to make a smartphone game? Everybody has a smartphone. If you want to test it out, just grab, you know, everybody has an iPhone. Just grab somebody's iPhone and throw it on there. You know, there's like, there's really, you don't need literally, really anything to get into smartphone, you know, game development. That's the big deal.
Well, and the thing is, you can release just absolute dreck on phones and still make money on it, unfortunately.
Yeah, on volume. Just on volume alone.
Is that still true, though?
Yeah.
I think so.
I mean...
Temple Run made a lot of money, and Temple Run is pretty crap.
That's garbage.
It depends, but there's not a really easy solution to this. I mean, I think Sony thought they were being really clever by opening up, you know,
Sony thinks they're very clever every day.
Well, but Sony's like, what if we let Android developers make Vita games?
Oh my god.
Yeah.
And it really hasn't turned into anything, you know, because the install base isn't there.
Yeah.
I think if Nintendo went that direction, it would be different and it would be more impactful than it has been for Sony. But still, I think the people who make games on those kinds of platforms don't really care that much about 3DS. And Gum and Clive is a rare exception, because that was an iOS game. Mm-hmm. And the guy took the, you know, is a one-man development team, and he took the effort to actually recode it to be compatible with 3DS. And it seems to be paying off for him, but there just aren't many examples of people like that. And I think a lot of people who develop on those platforms are so committed and obsessed with and evangelical about those platforms that they think stuff like 3DS is really antiquated and they just don't care about it. Anyway, guys, I think that's going to have to wrap it up. But thanks to everybody who wrote in. We'll try to get some more emails maybe next week. So be sure to send those in to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Before we go, we do want to remind everyone that we will be returning to PAX East. That's the Penny Arcade Expo East in Boston, Massachusetts, United States of America, planet Earth. That will be on March 22nd. That's a Saturday. The show's already sold out, so if you don't have a ticket, you're probably fucked. But hey, check StubHub or, you know, if you are planning to be at PAX East, of course, we really, really hope that you will check us out. And, even if you can't come see our panel, Connectivity Crew will be doing Who Wants to Be a Nintendo Heir on the next day, Sunday the 23rd. And the last time I looked, there were still tickets available for that. So you might be able to still check them out. Maybe you can sneak into the show the day before. Let us know. We'll see what we can do. But we probably can't do anything, because Saturday is going to be madness. Of course, if you can't make it to PAX East, we will be recording the whole panel and we'll put it up on the podcast feed, so don't worry. But it's better if you can come, it's better. So we're also, I just wanted to remind everyone that we're also putting all of our t-shirts on sale over at the NWR t-shirts shop. And I got a comment on Twitter that this thing is too hard to find. So I'm going to be working on that. I'm going to try to get like an image up on the front page of Nintendo World Report so you can click on that. There will also be a link buried. Unfortunately, it will be a text link that you have to look for in the article, but that will take you there.
We can do pictures.
And if nothing else, you can always type in ninwr.spreadshirt.com. And all of them are there. We've recently reduced the prices on everything. I might even try to get in a couple of new designs in time for PAX East. If you would like to order a shirt and wear it to the show, I do highly recommend ordering it before the end of February, because it does take a couple of weeks for them to print it and ship it. So just to be safe, don't wait, okay? But there's some really nice shirts in there. I actually just ordered a couple new ones for myself. And I'm looking forward to seeing some of those out there in Boston. Wanted to remind everyone that you can always rate and review the show on iTunes, and we would really appreciate that. It does help people find the show, which lets us get new emails and extra participation and retroactive and at the live panel. It just makes the show better. The more people listen to it, the better it gets. That has always proven to be the case, I find. So you can help us out and make this show better by rating and reviewing us on iTunes. You can also keep up with the show a couple other ways. We have a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/radiofreenintendo, or just do a search. Very easy to find, I promise you. And if you like us on there, then you'll get little updates every time the new episodes roll out. Sometimes we, you know, give you reminder links to things like retroactive polls and t-shirt store and, you know, all kinds of little updates like that. Post pictures from the live panels and little fan art and all kinds of crazy stuff like that. So
like us and we'll enter you for a prize to win
nothing. Yeah. So definitely check that out over Facebook. And on Twitter, all four of us can be found on Twitter. Actually, I'm at Johnny Metz. That's no H and no Z. And James is?
It's NWR_James.
All right, John.
Mr. Diamond J. MR Diamond, letter J.
Yeah, boy. And Guillaume is?
Guillaume, NWR, to answer your question. Yes.
If you don't know how to spell Guillaume, go to the website, go to our website, and you'll find it on there. That's all the plugs. We're done. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We hope you enjoyed it, and we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Later.
you know, like, it will leave you kind of, what's the expression? Like, on your appetite?
Unsatisfied.
Aroused?
Aroused. Yes, it will leave you aroused and unsatisfied. It will leave you unsatisfied.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a lot of trips to the club. It's because she's the president of Japan.
Well, maybe Ika-chan is president of Japan as well.
Yeah, James.
She probably isn't, because I'm reasonably certain that squid aren't eligible to run for office.
Neither are 15-year-old girls.
You never know in the future, James. In the future, where squids are super intelligent, you don't know this.
Squids are already pretty damn smart, to be
fair. It's true.
Yeah, I will say that my favorite part about this game is that they could... The title tells you exactly what it is, assuming you actually speak Japanese.
Oh.
Ika-chan just means... little squid, or it could be squid girl, depending on how you want to go with it. But
it's easy to trademark in
it is. It's incredibly easy to trademark, and if you called it Squid Girl, nobody would buy it.
Right. It would sound like a DSiWare game.
Yeah, it would. No, it actually wouldn't. It would sound like a game that you couldn't get on Nintendo systems.
Squid Girl? It's PC only in Japan, which means it's porn.
Everyone loves tentacle rape. Jokes.
That's right. And they probably own manga and read it backwards. You know, like they read it right
because
to left.
I don't recall any companies licensing and dubbing Fist of the North Star into English. But if they did, I would have loved to have been in the voice acting sessions.
It's gonna be so
the
hard.
The other thing is that game probably doesn't count. Oh,
please.
Painful. Oh,
that's all that show does. It's awesome.
It's literally that.
Is this the Koei game?
I think it is.
Because that game is supposedly awful. So, great.
Well, basically a reskin of Dynasty Warriors, right?
It is, except people blow up when you punch them.
Yeah, it's weird that JC's such a massive fan of it.
No, it's not.
I mean, to each his own.
He moved to Japan. No, it's not. He's already messed up in the head.
Yeah, well, hold on. I guess we can guess that he moved to Japan. I mean, we don't know who JC's is, guys.
Maybe that's the reason.
Yes.
Maybe he went there to be closer to the people who created Fist of the North Star.
He went there to be closer to the actual Fist of the North Star.
Let us know. We'll see what we can do. But we probably can't do anything. Because Saturday is going to be madness.
By the way, Johnny just encouraged listeners to go ahead and break and enter into the BECE.
I'm just saying Woodstock was a thing.
Look,
you know,
there's
babies were born, people died, but generally it was a pretty cool weekend.
There's a huge glass ceiling over the main exhibition hall that you could probably break into and parachute down three stories.
Yep,
that's right. Rent a helicopter.
There you go.
And Mission Impossible.
Yeah, totally endorse this and sign off on it.
Go get Mission Impossible for the N64. Go ahead and use that as your practice. Don't gas everybody in the building. No, that's not acceptable.
No, that's not cool.
And then just go ahead and get to our panel, and then hopefully security doesn't tackle you as you're coming in.
But you can punch them out. I mean, they're usually not that tough. I mean, they're a bunch of gamer dudes.
And don't forget to bring your 3DS, because the spot pass is going to be tight.
That's right. Spot passes while your skin...
Street pass.
So find a way to get it into your skin suit, because you're going to need that when you come through the ceiling.
Or you can perhaps reinforce it, beat down the security guards with it.
Right, and you can street pass us while your security guard is beating living crap out of you, unless my street pass is full, and then I'm sorry.
And then when you get out of jail in 20 years and they hand your possessions back to you, you can check out the Street Pass Plaza.
No, you can't, because your battery will have died, and those don't save if the battery dies.
Exactly.
Of course, if you can't make it to PAX East...
Transition in a way that I can easily excise this whole thing.
Nope. This is gold.
Don't do it.
Of course, if you can't make it to PAX East, we will be recording the whole panel, and we'll put it up on the podcast feed, so don't worry. But it's better if you can come, it's better.
In a skin suit.
Yeah.
You get to touch us.
No, you don't.
You get to touch James.
No, you don't. I have bear mace.
I give out free hugs. I have deer antler spray.
James will be wearing spikes. John will be hugging everyone.
I will. It's the year of hugs. 2013 is the year of the hug.
So definitely check that out over Facebook. And on Twitter, all four of us can be found on Twitter.
There's so many plugs.
Oh my gosh. Plugs. Oh, you can find us at RFNplugs on Twitter. I'm just kidding. Actually, I'm at Johnny Metz. That's no H and no Z. And James is?
It's NWR_James.
All right. John.
Mr. Diamond J. MR Diamond letter J.
Yeah, boy. And Guillaume is?
I don't know. You tell me.
NWR underscore Gil.
Well, let me just scroll down here and I'll find it.
This is the worst plug segment ever.
I would say it's the best.
This is the most sideways plug segment ever.
And Guillaume is at Guillaume NWR.
At Guillaume NWR.
Yes. If you don't know how to spell Guillaume, go to the website, go to our website, and you'll find it on there.
Google it.
Spell like Guile.
Yeah.
From Street Fighter.
Spell like Guile.
Make sure to switch your keyboard to French Canadian.
Oh, yeah. You'll need some special characters. You need to get that accent aigu in there.
Circonflex, circonflex.
Jesus.
That's all the plugs. We're done. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We hope you enjoyed it, and we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Later.
Special characters in my Twitter handle. We still have to record now, playing.
Yep.
All right, guys, let's clap.
Jesus!
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I'm gonna have so much fun.